now.
101 WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit. Welcome to WRIF's award-winning Night Call, Detroit's longest-running phone-in talk show with Peter Werby and Jolene Jordan. Peter and Jolene will be voicing their opinions, and they want to hear yours. Call them at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Now, here are Peter and Jolene.
Well, welcome to the broadcast. Jolene Jordan, how are you?
I'm doing fine. I just took a little cough suppressant so I could make it through the show.
That's good. It's been hanging on.
Time of year. Yeah, anyone have any homeopathic remedies for me? I'm down with it.
Hey, did you go trick-or-treating?
Yeah, that's why my throat's like this now. You know, I actually did the, this is bad, I hate to admit this publicly, in a large city on a very big radio station, but I shut the lights off tonight. I had a lot of preparation for tonight's show because tonight is a big show. I had a Tuesday's midterm elections, and we have a lot to talk about. In fact, we've decided we're going to talk for an hour solid.
Yeah, we're going to do it commercial free. The elections are coming up.
For the first hour.
The majority of you are not going to vote.
And you better.
Well, I mean,
I'm going to spank you.
You know, people, me?
Anyone who doesn't
oh,
vote.
Oh, no, I was getting... I said, what is this, the Howard Stern show?
Well, we've been accused of that
yeah,
at times.
But, you know, people are always, you have to vote, you know, be a good citizen to vote. And most people don't. I mean, when
30% like, is the average.
Really?
32%.
And that's of registered voters.
Yes.
And everyone isn't registered.
Right.
So this is all going to come down to maybe 15% of the American people, the adults, that are going to decide what's going on after November 2nd.
Well, I'm hoping that those numbers, because there's been so much talk, especially in the media, sometimes it's good, of how few people, you know, telling people that they're worried about the numbers and the Democrats losing the House and blah, 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 that maybe that'll inspire a few more people to get on out there.
It might, but I still think that there's... a large measure of disgust in general. And there's a lot of disappointment about the Democrats. And so that'll leave the stage open for a small percentage of people to be able to elect some Republicans.
You know what? I think it's really childish. It's like a little kid who doesn't get their way, who goes and pouts in a corner. You know what I'm saying?
I mean, people that
don't
are,
vote because they're so disgusted. That's a bunch of BS. It's no excuse in my book. Sorry.
I'm
going hardcore.
I've often, over the years, not voted out of disgust.
I know that, Peter.
Yeah.
But, you know.
But here. Let's say this. We want to talk, too, about the rally to restore sanity. And a friend of mine said...
And or fear is
yeah.
what it was called, because Colbert was the fear part. I cried for the first 2 hours of
really?
From laughter.
Oh, okay.
Oh, yeah.
Well, a friend of mine said, when was there sanity here?
Yeah, that's a good point.
But, yeah.
But, you know, they're saying in this current political climate, that's why they did it.
Well, I want to talk about that. In fact, if anybody attended that rally, I know a couple people. I don't know whether they're back or not. Oh, I should say, by the way, this would give the number again, 313-298-WRIF. If you'd like to comment about the elections or anything else, we call it open line. It means you can bring up any subject you like, and we'll field it. Express your opinions. Of course, we'll give ours as well. That's 313-298-9743. Hey, I took your job away.
You did. That's okay.
Yeah. If you want to email
You're
us.
Saving my voice.
It's call, talk, yes, at yahoo.com, so you can yell at people.
Yeah, we got a couple of doozies last week.
Emails.
You know?
Oh, no, emails, too,
emails.
Telling us we're intolerant, we're too harsh, and
yeah.
and all of that.
And everyone keeps saying how cool and level-headed Peter Werby is, but all I hear is hate.
Hate. That's not what you're saying. That's what the emailer said.
Yeah.
Well, the only thing I'm always surprised, a lot of people who like the show, that like you and I doing what we do here, they'll say that I'm so fair and all that. I'm not very fair. I never made any. I mean, I'll start being fair when the righties start being fair.
You're a lot. You have to. Okay, that's a deal.
That's not very interesting. I mean, people should passionately give their point of view. And if they want to make some insults and, you know, like I do not care. That people are drawing Hitler mustaches on the faces of politicians, even Barack Obama. I mean, there was more of a reason that we I don't think I ever did it specifically, but would ever draw a Hitler mustache on Bush, who, by the way, was at the Rangers and Giants game. I wonder if he got
and
booed.
Daddy and Bush, Mama were
the
there,
guy
too.
Responsible for it all.
Yeah.
Remember what they used to say about George Bush in Iraq? They said he should pull out like his daddy should have.
Oh, amen.
But it's not very unusual for the party in power that just elected the president to get hammered. Because when we think of, like, really, truly well-loved presidents and respected and all that, Franklin Delano Roosevelt certainly right at the top of the list. In 1938, the Republicans won 72 seats in the House.
Wow.
They don't expect anything like that now. In 1946, Republicans swept both houses after Harry Truman had been elected. Let me see. Was he elected in
1946?
Yeah. No, he was the vice president. That's right. He didn't get elected until 48.
It's not uncommon.
No, it's not uncommon. In 1966, after the Johnson victory, Republicans picked up 47 seats. In 1994, the Republicans added 52 House seats. So that's not unusual. What would be unusual if, in fact, people saw these Republicans are a different matter?
With the inclusion of the baggers?
The baggers, the tea baggers, yeah. But we'll see. Whatever. I mean, I don't know how to slice it.
Que sera, sera, what will be on Tuesday.
You know, Noam Chomsky, who I have great respect for, he said, the farther you are away from the centers of wealth and power, the more that it matters who is the president and who controls the Congress and what have you. If you're an Afghan peasant, an Iraq farmer, it really matters. If you're a desperately poor person in the United States, it really matters. I'll tell you, for a middle-class white boy like me, nothing's going to change greatly. I could think of some ways that it would. But, I mean, the people that it's going to really affect directly ought to consider this very deeply and think who best, and this is key, who best supports your interests? I mean, what's the easy answer? Neither party!
Yeah.
Yeah, well, I said best. I mean, we're talking about the lesser of the two evils, right?
I mean, that a lot.
It's hard for things to come down to that we're thinking, well, who's going to screw us the least? Mm-hmm. And the fact that some people think that they're going to have a better shot with the Republicans that are making under $250,000 a year just surprises me. But let's get to the rally in Washington, the rally to restore
sanity and or fear.
Yeah. Now, how many people showed up? According to CBS News, 215,000 people showed up for the rally on Saturday. By comparison, CBS estimated that's 87,000, 40% of the Sanity rally, attended Glenn Beck's Restoring Honor rally in August.
They're saying just, yeah.
Yeah, so that 215,000 for the rally yesterday, 87,000, and the Beck loonies were saying there was 500,000 people there.
But there were a lot of those. There were baggers there yesterday.
There were?
Yeah.
Why would they go? They don't want to restore sanity.
No, they're the fear part.
Oh, but they didn't. It was so obvious.
And most
obvious.
Of those fear people were
fake.
They were fake and know that Colbert is not an ultra-conservative.
Yeah, so, I mean...
Well, he's one funny guy, though.
John Stewart insists that he's even-handed and that he's as critical of the extremists on the left, whoever the hell they are, with the extremists on the right.
Some would say that's us.
Well, that's okay. But, I mean, do we really represent us and our particular far-left opinions really represent very many people? Yes.
Yes.
It's just that there's no way for people to express it. They get to express the kind of what's called far-left value. Here's what's far-left. Here's what's far-left. We don't want unwinnable wars. In fact, we don't want any wars unless they're absolutely necessary. And there hasn't been one of those in a very, very long time, 50 years, 60 years or something like that. We want a national health care program.
Yep.
You know, I was looking for the old folks about Medicare, and I always wonder how bureaucratic is it. And in today's Free Press, they had a whole section on Medicare. And I figure if the country hasn't gone completely broke, by the time I want to get Medicare, that I ought to know a little about it. And I couldn't make heads and tails of it.
Really?
Oh, I mean, it's so incredibly complicated. So what we really need is, and that's far left for some reason or other, and that would be a national single-payer healthcare system.
Yes.
Where you get rid of all of this. You're sick, you go in, right? You need medicine, you get it. What else? Free university tuition. And so that's far left. Although
alternative energy.
Yeah, that's exactly what they have in other countries. And some of it are even run by conservatives, say like Britain.
True.
But anyway, let's see. Canada's CTV wrote that 250,000 people were estimated to have taken part in the rally to restore sanity. Brian Stelter? Do you know who that is? I don't know. Tweeted that the Park Service approximated that well over 200,000 attended Saturday's rally. I don't know if you've seen any of the photos. I mean, I'm not even sure all this matters, but that because here's two networks. One, Comedy Central. We get Comedy Central. They get Foxhole News or Faux News, F-A-U-X, right? Fake news. And you could tell by the photographs of the Beck rally that there wasn't anywhere near what was even at that at the March 1963 Martin Luther King March. But you know which march between this the one yesterday and the Beck rally was probably most effective or will have the most effect on reality? I think the Beck rally.
Because
they are organized. They're out for blood.
Yeah, that's true.
They are
because
ready to roll.
They're on the bottom.
Well,
so you know,
they're scratching their way to the top. They don't call the John Stewart people activists. They call them, you heard this, slacktivists.
Oh, geez.
And this is the part of the spectacle. I know that, you know, the Glenn Beck thing is. The spectacle is they're this small group of active communicators, particularly television. And they define reality, they define agendas, they speak for people. And of course, they're always funneling you into commodity consumption. But the other part of it is this huge, undifferentiated mass of passive receptors.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So the idea is you don't really do much. You stay tuned. Every once in a while you're called out to do something like buy or vote. In the main, the whole idea that we have talk show hosts that are leading movements, although Jon Stewart does not have a movement. That was an event.
Yeah, it was.
That was like a rock concert.
It really was.
And I think it represents the majority of people. People don't like to hear all this hatred, don't like to hear all these threats of violence. And I don't think by calling people teabaggers or right-wing wackos that that's really hatred, because I'm not trying to stir up anybody to do awful things towards other people. There's not this underlying hatred of ethnic groups or religions or anything like that. I'm not trying to instill fear in anyone, because think about this. Let's take the criticism of the Obama administration in a reasonable manner. All right. And by the way, if there's anybody that has comments along the line, please give us a call. 313-298-WRIF. 313-298-9743.
I was looking for an article here.
You're fired. But actually I got off track there. What was I saying? Trying to instill, fear and what. Oh, yeah, yeah. If Obama, let's take it in a dispassionate manner. Everything that Obama has done has been misguided, wrong, bad policy. That's the key to it, bad policy. It's bad policy. He's not as, where did I just see that insane little thing that, I don't know if I can find it, but the kind of extreme language represents, oh, here it is. The ultimate expose on the radical nature of our 44th president, the Manchurian president, Barack Obama's ties to communist socialists and other anti-American extremists. I mean, this is wacko talk. This is insane people that have no capacity to discern reality. And that means what happens? What's the phrase for it? Psychotic. That if you can't discern reality in any real way. But
we tried to find other names, but it really comes down to that one word.
But let's go back to this. Say everything that Barack Obama is done is wrong. Well, there's a couple of things that would happen. For one thing, we would find that out because these policies wouldn't work. And people say, well, if his policies don't work, that the effect on the country would be anywhere from bad to catastrophic. Well, we've already suffered the catastrophic results of Reaganomics and into their most extreme form under the Bush regime of 2001 to 2009. Things have only gotten better since then. This TARP, the troubled asset, the TARP funds that went to bail out the banks, you know, we talked about that before. Pretty, that no one feels good about that, rewarding the people that caused all this. Yeah. But again, that was a Bush program and probably saved this country from a collapse, an absolute collapse. But, let's see. One of the things that goes through these right wingers and that is so disturbing is this level an implied threat of violence. And it is really fascistic. And I don't use that word to describe anybody I dislike or that doesn't agree with me. I don't use that in a manner to say anybody on the right wing is a fascist or something like this. But fascistic in the way of ultimately having their way politically through violence or threat of violence. And you get that all over, whether it's...
Yeah, look what we've seen in the last year.
Yeah, those guys stomping on the head of that woman up in Alaska.
I actually finally saw the video of that. Yeah. It was unbelievable. And his excuse for it was that he has a bad back and he couldn't bend over to restrain her, so he had to do it with his big, dumb man foot.
Yeah, this was... what's his first name, Rand?
Rand Paul,
yeah, in Kentucky. And up in Alaska, this Joe Miller, who's a favorite of Sarah Palin.
He's going down.
Going down. That's good. And, of course, he has as a security detail, I think I mentioned that last week.
Oh, yes, a former Michigan militia member, isn't that
Norm
right?
Norm Olson. And you see this over and over and over again.
Now, what's the one, the one down in, is it Nevada?
Yeah, the Sharon Angle.
Oh, she's a real nut job.
Yeah.
And then Meg Whitman, nut job. Christine O'Donnell, nut job.
We got a little song by Christine O'Donnell in Delaware.
Yeah, we're going to play that, aren't we?
We're going to play. It's Halloween.
Yeah, that's right.
But let's finish up with this. Now, these anti-abortion people in North Carolina, they have these doctors worried that they're marked for murder by Operation Save America. And these are teabaggers. They put out these wanted posters with depicting doctors in North Carolina who perform abortions. Now, you may be opposed to abortion, but this is a legally sanctioned medical procedure.
Roe v. Wade, baby, 1972.
The privacy. And the most militant people and the murderers of these doctors have already assassinated doctors. They're men. Right?
That's right.
Yeah, they have men wanting to terrorize women out of having abortions.
Yeah. What they ultimately would like to do is control women's bodies.
One of the doctors who said he had to remain anonymous says, it doesn't say wanted dead or alive, but the implications are clearly there. He says, I'm always looking over my shoulder. I know they know my car. They know my face. They've been to my house. They put these posters in my neighborhood. And those responsible for the flyers, Operation Save America, and they protest abortions at women's clinics, they list specific addresses and urge people to contact doctors through their home addresses.
Oh, yeah. When I was a news reporter for the ABC affiliate back home, I covered a lot of this. It was Operation Rescue at the time. Remember that, Peter?
Sure.
This could be the same people, you know, with a revamped name. But I got to kind of know how these people operated, see it firsthand, and really, they're worse than psychotic. They're dangerous.
And one of the worst and one of the most reprehensible political human beings on the planet that makes me almost want to give Sarah Palin a big hug.
Really?
Is Ted Nugent.
I know. I just
can't
tolerate
him. Usually I stay away from this guy, but he increasingly is beginning to function less and less like a rock star whose music we love, and more and more like a vicious, threatening, almost psychotic politician.
Yeah, he's really gone. He's just lost his mind completely.
I think so.
He's in trouble for his hunting.
Yeah,
tell us. Right now, well, first of all, he's banned in a couple of states, one being California.
Well, because he was he didn't have his license. He was and on television. He was killing young deer.
Yeah, he was, what do they call that, deer baiting.
Yeah, deer baiting. Right. That was illegal.
Now, oh, yeah, they revoked it August 13th. Deer baiting, not having properly. Now, in South Dakota, looks like he was shooting pheasants. And here's the deal. In South Dakota, they honor the revocation of a hunting license from other states. So he was, he's got, did you see the picture of him holding up the dead pheasant?
Well,
proud.
How about this? He said, "My name is Ted Nugent because of Pam Anderson and because of Paul McCartney, all members of PETA. Whenever I hear the word animal or rights in the same paragraph, I'm killing an extra 100 of something this year. I have unlimited deer tags in Michigan and Texas, and I don't even need to kill them, really, but I'm going to." This is a fairly sick human being.
Can't you find a better way to spend your time?
But here, this was, where is this from? Oh, this is from Juan Cole. Go to Juan Cole, JUANCOLE.com. He says, Nugent's rhetorical technique is to dehumanize his opponents. Nancy Pelosi does not have a political ally, but a puppet. The Democratic representatives are not humans, but rats. He's talking about Al Franken and John Dingell from Michigan, of course, and Nancy Pelosi. They are rodents and varmints. He even used the language of mass murder against them. He calls for them to be fumigated. Remember the rats. He called them the rats in the Democratic Party, and that's what that's how the Nazis referred to the Jews, and they had images of them as rats.
He needs to find other ways to express himself.
And there's always, when you hear him, there's this just sort of low level of threat to him.
Yeah, yeah. I mean,
that and Juan Cole goes on about Ted Nugent, that the Democratic Party is the party of urban ethnic minorities, of Italian and Polish Catholics, of Jews, of Latinos and African Americans, of women, and that Nugent was demonizing them before an all-white rally in West Virginia underlies the ethnic tensions in which he was implicitly playing, and in that context, his imagery of extermination is extremely smelly.
He really does belong in the state of Texas. You know what's sad, Peter, is I met him when Riff was in the old building. He was doing an interview with someone while I was on the air, and he was in, like, Studio B. And he was just the nicest guy, I have to say. But that was before he went nuts, you know. And he was in his little, like, grandpa vest and his little grandpa loafers, and I thought, well, this is the Motor City Madman? Wow, okay. And then through the years, he's just gotten increasingly crazier.
Here also, Juan Cole continues, Nugent contrasts the vermin in Congress to an imagined organic community of hunters, churchgoers, and bowlers who must... And here, this guy's a millionaire, right? And he's always talking about the common people and all.
He's a multimillionaire.
Yeah, he's a multimillionaire. The use of fascist imagery, of solidarity-producing activities, producing a martial commitment is striking. Only about 4% of Americans hunt and only 10% fish. Less than a third regularly go to church. The organic army he is raising is clearly white, relatively well-off, unusually religious, and able to afford rural estates. Nugent was born and raised in old white industrial Detroit, but now lives on a farm from which he did a reality show for clueless city slickers, such as his teenage self had been. His flourish is to end an ominous black and white note. The political battle, he says, is not a matter of choosing good over evil, good over bad, rather, but good over evil. Nugent, says Juan Cole, is a horrible human being, perhaps not all there.
Wow.
He told a British journalist of Iraq in 2006, our failure has been not to Nagasaki them.
Gee whiz.
Yeah, I mean.
Yeah. Okay, G.I. Joe, Rambo, whatever.
So, you know, we're not doing any commercials this hour because there's so much to talk. Well, you know,
do have full lines.
Yeah, we do have full lines.
Everybody, so hold on.
I got a little bit more about the elections, but I've had my say. What do they say on the BBC?
Enough of me. Now, let's talk about me.
No, BBC. What do they say? Have your say. Something like that. All right. Let's go right off the bat to Sean in Washington, Michigan. Isn't that where the Octagon House is, Sean?
That is correct.
You are on the air, my friend.
How you doing?
I'm doing excellent.
I gotta say, occasionally I'll catch your show back in the day when I first got in the military, and you just made me angry.
Okay.
It happens.
But I gotta say, though, honestly, I've been out now for about 4.5, 5 years, and my opinion's drastically changed.
Really?
I mean, I still have my conservative viewpoints, but kind of seeing the both sides of the fence. And I voted for Obama. I'm the worst Democrat I ever voted for in my life. I'm not going to lie to you. But I think some of the things they're saying against him are pretty hateful and almost warmongering. And some of the things that you're saying about Ted Nugent and what he talks about these people, for one, a guy that never served in the military, who dodged the draft in the early 70s, from my understanding.
He's a draft dodger.
He's the most outspoken and pro-military out there when he never served. And I've come to the conclusion, a lot of these pro-hardcore conservatives, serve your country, red, white, and blue guys like Rush Limbaugh, Beck, so on and so forth, never served, dodged the draft, college educated, very rich and white. No offense, I'm white too, but it just seems like
the guys
conservative values and serve the country and fight these wars or sit back armchair quarterback and everything and don't have a, I don't know, it just makes me angry.
Well, now what, Jillian, what was that phrase, chicken hawk, wasn't it?
Chicken hawk.
I mean, a lot of these guys are getting to the retirement age, but it was interesting in, 10 years ago, the overwhelming majority of Democratic leadership in the House of Representatives, particularly, were all veterans of Vietnam or other branches of the service, or not necessarily of Vietnam, some of them served later, and it was like zero for the Republicans, and there was this phrase, and it's worth doing a Google on, chicken hawk, because you go down the line, all these guys saying, yeah, Sean and your buddies, go off and fight this war and that war, and not a single one of them did anything. Dick Cheney, the warmonger of all warmongers, he said that, what was his phrase, something about that he was more important for him to go to college during the Vietnam era.
Yeah, you know, like I said, I hear a lot of stuff, and I've come to another conclusion, and I'm not trying to, make everybody, paint everybody the same shade of gray, but overall, I always feel that the less traveled, the ones that travel the less, who've not gone to other countries, not been to other places, are the most conservative and most hardened on their views, and if anything, don't open up their viewpoints to others. And like I said, I was very conservative, but over the years, and me traveling most parts of the world, There's always two sides of the fence, you know.
Well, you're right. And Sean, one thing, there is a group called Iraq Veterans Against the War. And I think it's just, let me see,
IVAW.org.
IVAW.org. All right, I want to get some more calls.
Peter, really quick, a chicken hawk. Thank
you so much.
For those people who are driving and aren't going to be Googling while they're driving, it is meant to indicate that the person in question is cowardly or hypocritical for personally avoiding combat in the past, while advocating that others go to war. But I can't remember the actual chicken hawk.
You mean the site?
Oh, here we go.
Yeah.
It's a compound of chicken meaning coward and hawk meaning someone who advocates war. Okay, that was easy.
Yeah. Right. And like George W. Bush was able to escape going to Vietnam because his rich daddy leaped him all way over all these other applicants for the Texas Air National Guard because people.
Which he even went AWOL.
Yeah, he did.
Proven.
Yeah. All right. Peter Werby and Jillian Jordan, we're doing a commercial free for this hour. I want to get your opinions. Let me look here. Nobody has any opinions about the rally to restore sanity and what's the other part of it?
And or fear,
right.
Well, I would highly recommend it if everyone out there, if you want to see one of the most funny moments of television ever, just go to YouTube and put in Yusuf, which is Cat Stevens, Y-U-S-U-F, and Ozzy Osbourne. And it's just priceless.
Well, we can tell him, I think, a little of it.
Yeah, because Jon Stewart said he had Yusuf Cat Stevens, formerly known as Cat Stevens, come out and do Peace Train. And then Stephen Colbert interviewed, no, stop. I will not get on your Peace Train. I will not. And he brought in Ozzy for the Crazy Train. So Ozzy did the Crazy Train. Then John's like, stop.
I'm
no, Yusuf,
off.
Come here. And they went back and forth. And in the end, Yusuf and Ozzy were so tired of these guys. I mean, it was all, you could tell,
They went off hugging.
It was great.
And, Jon Stewart saying, wait a minute, he's talking about going off the rails. Hey, we were talking, it's Halloween, and you may remember this silly person that from the teabag movement, Christine McDonald.
O'Donnell.
I can't remember.
I'll be here to help you every time, Peter, because you're never going to get it right.
I know. She did this ad where she said, I am not a witch because
she had dabbled in witchcraft.
She said that on the Bill Maher show.
Yeah, a few years ago.
So there is something called auto-tune. And what that does, it can correct your pitch if you're a singer, but it can also take, like, it could record what Jalene and I are saying now and make a song out of it. So here is, I hope this will work.
There's an idea.
Right.
Werby and Jordan in auto-tune.
Yes, here, and man, this thing has had 1.5 million
views. Are you ready to go?
Yeah, I'm probably going to screw it up, but let's let's give it a try here.
All right.
I'm not a witch.
Oh, God.
I'm nothing you've heard. I'm you. I'm not a witch. Bitch. None of us are perfect, but none of us can be happy with what we see all around us. Politicians who think spending, trading favors, and backroom deals are the ways to stay in office. Stay in office. Politicians, stay in office. I'll go to Washington and do what you do. I'm Christine O'Donnell, not a politician and not a witch. Bitch. I'm Christine O'Donnell. I'm you. I'm not a witch. I'm nothing you've heard. None of us are perfect, but none of us can be happy with what we see all around us. Politicians who think spending, trading favors, and backroom deals are the ways to stay.
All right, you get it. You get it. That's Christine O'Donnell, and that's using auto-tune.
I'm you. No, honey, you're not. You'll never be me.
Well, all right. And, yeah, you can just Google that.
I think there are a lot of parodies on her on YouTube.
Yeah, that's amazing. What are we going to do for laughs when these people...
Well, they're like cockroaches, Peter. They always come back.
Well, but here's the deal. If the Republicans really sweep things, they're going to get in. And so what do you think is going to change, folks? You think, wow, they're really going to change everything. Nothing's going to change. In fact, it will be the crazy train that these whack jobs that they've got out there. Well, I think the ones that will get elected really aren't the crazy people.
Are you sure?
No.
Okay.
Who knows? I mean, who's gotten more press and media than Christine O'Donnell?
Yeah, right. The only good that can come out of that is that talk show hosts, progressive talk show hosts like you and I across the United States, will have plenty to talk about.
Yeah, but they are...
Let's hope it doesn't happen.
They really are just, as we've been saying, they're just cannon fodder. I mean, to be sure. Here, in today's New York Times... Frank Rich has the grand old plot, that's the GOP, right, the grand old party, against the Tea Party. Says the Tea Party's hopes for actually affecting change in Washington will start being dashed the morning after. So, I mean, if you were thinking about voting for any of these people, it's gone. As soon as they get into office, the ordinary Americans in this movement lack the numbers and financial clout to muscle their way into the back rooms of Republican power, no matter how well their candidates perform. Trent Lott, the former Senate leader and current top dog lobbyist, gave away the game in July. He said, "We don't need a lot of Jim DeMint disciples." He refers to the South Carolina senator who is the Tea Party patron saint. He says, "As soon as they get here," says this Republican, "we need to co-opt them. We need to co-opt them." That's what's going to happen to the teabaggers. It's the players who wrote the checks for the GOP surge, not the earnest folks in tri-corner hats who plan to run the table in the next corporate takeover of Washington. Karl Rove this month told Der Spiegel in Germany that Tea Parties are, quote, Tea Partiers are, quote, not sophisticated. That's what's talking about you. This is the Republican elite that laughs at you, that laughs at your concerns, because he's just about lower taxes for the rich people.
I kind of agree with him on this one, though.
Yeah, well,
The baggers are not sophisticated by any means.
That that you're the cannon fodder to put his corporatists back into power. That will make sure that there's no taxes on the rich. That'll make sure that corporations have less and less regulations. And the hostility is not gone unnoticed among those supposedly less sophisticated conservatives back home. Mike Huckabee, still steamed about Rove's previous put-down of Christine O'Donnell, publicly lamented the Republican establishment's elitism and country club attitude. This country club elite, he said, is happy for TTIP... Let me try it. It's happy for tea partiers to put up signs, work the phones, and make those pesky little trips door to door that it finds a frightful inconvenience. But the members won't let the hoi polloi, that's the ordinary people, dine with them in the club's main dining room any more than David Koch, the billionaire sugar daddy of the Republican right, will invite O'Donnell into his box at the David H. Koch Theater at Lincoln Center to take in the Nutcracker. The main dining room remains reserved for Koch's fellow oil barons. Trent Lott's clients, the corporate contributors, known and anonymous to groups like Rove's American Crosswords, and, of course, the large coterie of special interests in underwriting John Boehner, the presumptive next speaker of the House.
You're so bad.
Why? Why am I bad? John Boehner of Ohio. Now, what are these teabaggers all about, that how horrible this TARP was, how horrible the bailout was? Well, guess what? Boehner is the largest House recipient of Wall Street money this year, much of it from financial institutions bailed out by TARP. Let's go out one more time. John Boehner, who would become the House of Representative Majority Leader, the Speaker of the House, rather, is the largest House recipient of Wall Street money this year, much of it from the financial institutions bailed out by TARP, the Troubled Assets Recovery Fund. Maybe that's it. His Senate counterpart, Mitch McConnell, will be certain to stop any Tea Party hillbillies from disrupting his chapter of the club as he tried to stop Rand Paul in his own state's Republican primary. McConnell's pets in his chamber's freshman Republican class will instead be old-school conservatives like Dan Coats of Indiana, Rob Portman of Ohio, and if he squeaks in, Pat Toomey of Pennsylvania. The first two are former lobbyists. Toomey ran the corporate interest group, the Club for Growth. They can be counted on to execute an efficient distribution of corporate favors and pork after they make their latest swing through Capitol Hill's revolving door. What the Tea Party ostensibly wants most, less government spending and smaller federal deficits, is not remotely going to happen on the country club's Republican watch. The elites have no serious plans to cut anything except taxes and regulations of their favored industry. And you're going to vote for these people. I mean,
no,
you're a joke.
No, I'm not.
And you know why you're a joke? If you're thinking about this, because these rich guys are laughing at you. They have nothing but contempt for
they
you.
They really are.
They have nothing but contempt for you.
All the way to their hidden bank accounts.
Yeah. There's a lot more. Cool empirical data reveal the truth known by the Republican establishment. In August, CNN poll found that 2% of Americans consider themselves active members of the Tea Party.
2%.
Yeah.
Boy, they're getting a lot of attention.
Yeah, they are. Well, thanks
for that,
to
aren't they?
All right, let's go on. We're doing it commercial free this hour. A lot to talk about. Nobody. By the way, actually, here's somebody. Somebody's been waiting a long time. But no, Nick from Rochester Hills, you stay on because he didn't like it. And I want to get Phil on from Farmington, who's been waiting a long time. Hi, Phil, you're on the air.
Hey, how you guys doing?
We're doing great.
Good. I'm sorry. I'm not going to touch on you got some pretty heated.
It's okay.
Point out there. But no, I don't know if you guys caught the Rick Wagner interview on Fox 2 News here.
Remind me of Rick Wagner.
He's our next governor, right?
So, Rick Snyder.
Rick Snyder.
Oh, excuse me. I know that's how intelligent I am. Anyhow.
we screw up names all the time. Don't worry.
That's all right.
Well, probably part of the reason I'm calling, too, is about the marijuana use. Maybe that has something to do with my memory there. But he had a standpoint on the marijuana because he never smoked. And
Poor guy.
Wait. Let's.
He probably experimented.
Wait. Phil said... He said he never smoked.
I believe the guy. He's such a nerd, though, right? I believe he's just.
I know a lot of nerdy stoners.
Yeah.
I know, but I'm just saying for instance, because, you know, it's great he's got this economic plan and everything, but a hot topic for a lot of Michigan residents is, I mean, I voted for it. I mean, hey, let's. I mean, the medical usage, you know, I mean, you know, everybody's like, you know, just make it legal all of a sudden, but.
Well, sure. But look here, Phil, rather. Barack Obama says he is going to enforce marijuana laws, federal marijuana laws, even if California on Tuesday makes it legal. There's no way in the world that Virge Bonaro, the Democratic candidate, is going to say, I think that marijuana ought to be legalized. Everybody is afraid all the politicians are afraid.
They're afraid to touch it.
Yeah. So that's not very surprising. All right. Yeah. Thank you very much. Appreciate your call.
Peter, real quick, an email from Jeff, our friend in GOP Hell in Indiana. Your statement about Republicans not playing nice or fair and being perpetual liars and cowards reminded me of one of my favorite quotes by Adlai Stevenson. When Republicans stop lying about us, we will stop telling the truth about them. Love the show. Look forward to it every week. Thanks, Jeff.
Thank you. Yeah, you can email us at calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Calltalkyes@yahoo.com. We may read them if they are short. All right, let's go to Adrian from Warren. You're on next. He doesn't like what we said or I said about Ted Nugent, but
I expected that because, you know, this is the riff. This is Detroit.
Wait a minute. It's one thing to say we like his song.
I enjoy him on stage. Did I not? Did not just get done saying this earlier today.
Right. But
when he does the Fred Bear with the little campfire, I dig it, man.
And he can love George Bush and move down to Crawford, Texas.
Just do it.
But when he starts threatening violence.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's another story, man.
Right. Here's Nick in Rochester Hills. Nick, you didn't like the rally.
Nope, I did not like it.
Did you go? Were you there?
No, I was not there, but I watched it on Comedy Central.
Yeah, me too.
What didn't you like?
Well, first, I don't think the reason so many people went is because Americans don't like hatred and violence. I mean, Americans obviously love hatred and violence, as evidenced by all the movies and video games they eat up. I think the real reason so many people went is because they don't want to face reality and actually do something about the rather grim situation we're facing. It's so typical of Americans to bury their heads in the sand by immersing themselves in entertainment and emotion in the hope that some magical entity will make all their problems go away. Americans are literally getting their homes taken away from them by billionaire bankers, and all we have to show for it is a handful of teabagging idiots getting all the press and a bunch of other people who just want to sing songs and hold hands. Look at France. They're trying to raise their retirement age by just 2 years, and the entire country went on strike.
High school students,
well,
even.
And France does that. That's their thing, and I wish it were more that way here. I'm just going to say.
Yeah, go ahead.
You know, I get what you're saying, and Peter and I talked about this
yesterday. I agree more with you, Nick.
And there were a lot of points where I thought, yeah, whatever, okay? Even in John Stewart's speech, we talked about that, Peter.
Yep.
But I got to be honest with you, especially TikTok down to Tuesday and all of these nasty campaign ads and these baggers. I needed a little comic relief. I enjoyed the hell out of it, at least the first part of it before the speeches started happening.
Well,
I needed some comedy, and I laughed my ass off.
I mean, I'm all for peace and anti-war and all that, Nick. But
I've done enough serious stuff.
But I just watched Die Hard 2 last night.
You did? Peter, you're such a boy.
But, all right, point well taken. Anybody agree or disagree? 313-298-WRIF. Peter Werby and Jalene Jordan here with you on Night Call, taking your calls. And I did say right at the beginning, I thought that the Stuart Colbert rally was, in general, good. I mean, people were expressing that this dislike and this dissatisfaction and revulsion against the level of
the fear mongering
and the hate mongering that the far right wing teabaggers have brought to the political discourse when it has no basis. Let me tell you something about fascism too. Fascism arose in Europe because there was this enormous threat to societies from the left. There was this huge socialist and communist and anarchist movements in Spain and Italy and where else did it come? Germany. Oh yeah, I almost forgot about that. And so the people that were the most threatened, the industrialists, the financiers, the capitalist class, they had to utilize Hitler and Franco in Spain and Mussolini in Italy to protect their interests, and had this movement filled with crazy people who exalted violence, that had, you know, racial hatred, intolerance, that had these fake communities that they say that define their lives. There's nothing like this happening now. I mean, Barack Obama is not a leftist by any stretch of the imagination. I mean, it is, in fact, almost nutty to assign him that. I mean, here's what he's done so far. The Democrats and Obama, and in fact, there's an incredible amount of legislation that the Democrats have produced. They've made college loans more affordable. They had the Cash for Clunkers program. They had new consumer protections for credit card users. I'm sorry, right up the top is the health care coverage, which I'm not very fond of that bill myself, but it's certainly not this far left-wing view. Far left-wing view would be what? To have a health system like Canada.
Yeah.
Wow, those wild radicals. And that, who's the communist that that heads that country? Oh, yeah, that's right. He's a conservative. Yeah, Stephen Harper. The Democrats and Obama made it easier for women to challenge pay discrimination. They increased federal regulation of tobacco products. There you go, trying to get into our personal rights. He cracked down on waste in Pentagon weapons acquisition. He made a tax based on sexual orientation a federal hate crime. He gave businesses tax incentives to hire unemployed workers. Well, and tax credits for first-time homeowners. So where's the love? I mean, where is the commie in there? I mean, it's nuts. And anybody that says that there is this threat to the Constitution or anything like that, I mean, I got to say, you're nuts. Here's Adrian and Warren. Adrian, hi. It's Peter and Jeline. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you. I'm a big fan of your guys' show. I love listening to you guys at night, and I actually stay up just a little bit longer just to listen to some of the arguments you guys have.
Thank you.
But I'm just saying with Ted Nugent, I think you guys are going off of what the media is saying, but I actually know Ted Nugent personally, and he's a friend of our family, and my brother just came back from Iraq, and he was seriously injured, and Ted Nugent takes some of the soldiers, and he actually entertains them and feeds them and stuff, and I listened to some of his philosophies, and he's actually very intelligent, and you guys are saying that he is crazy, and I know he was tagged with the Motor City Madman, but some of his philosophies are actually very accurate. I mean, you knock down a tree, you plant two more. You shoot an animal. Obviously, you don't waste the animal. You eat it, and you try to raise or feed a couple more animals to replenish it, you know what I mean?
Okay, so we're not saying he's a 100% horrible
and also,
individual.
Yeah, I mean, most hunters have an environmental side to them because they realize that most of them love nature. I mean, some of them just want to go kill animals. But he's a little kill crazy when it comes to
wouldn't you
to
admit
hunting.
He's a little kill crazy?
I understand. He does come across like that a little bit when he talks. But the way he talks and the way he makes himself sound and the way the media blows it up, it's two totally different things.
Well, wait,
he blows it up himself, I think.
Yeah. But, I mean, maybe he might do that purposely. But, Adrian, when he starts talking about fumigating the rats in the Democratic Party.
Yeah.
Isn't that a little scary?
Well, everyone's entitled to their own opinion.
Well, they're entitled to their own opinion, but we're also...
But that doesn't make it okay.
Yeah, and it also... Doesn't it sort of poison the public dialogue to have that kind of phraseology? I mean, again, rats were the imagery that the Nazis used and talked about exterminating the Jews. And here's this guy talking about exterminating, fumigating the rats. I don't know.
Well, He does form a kind of high-strung opinion on some of the politicians out there. And, I mean, I kind of agree with him in some points that he makes because some of the politicians are really trying to screw over the country, literally. But,
well, mostly the ones he supports. Well,
but
all right. Well, yeah, but what?
Can I make a quick comment, though?
Sure, please.
I would like to say that, because I know a lot of people are listening to the show tonight, but for all the hot rod owners in Michigan, the government is going to try to take away all of the hot rods from us.
Right.
And just to vote, I'm not kidding. If you get CarCraft or you get Hot Rod Magazine, they had a big article about it also. Anything that's older than 10 years old, they're going to try to take it away. They've already started doing it in California.
Oh, you're talking about emissions?
No, I'm talking about your cars. Physically, they're trying to take away your individualism and your right to creativity.
I severely doubt that.
What?
Hit Snopes. Snopes.com. Adrian, we'll do it
How
here.
How could they take your hot rod?
Because the jackbooted thugs of the federal government will come and say, we want your chopped and channeled 49 Merc for some reason. All
that
right, Adrian, we'll look that up.
So not true.
You got to be real, real careful with this stuff. But can you go to Snopes? Snopes.com and put just hot rod. All right. Here's Matt
it.
And Romeo. Matt, hi. You're on the air.
Hey, Jillian. Hey, Peter. How are you doing?
Hi.
Hi.
Hello. Hey, I want to talk about Snyder as well with the governor race here in Michigan.
Sure.
I'm just curious if he caught his one and only debate he agreed to do a few weeks ago when he was asked how he had to address the state's budget and later the public education budget.
You know, Matt,
yeah,
I would never, ever
sit through one of those.
I have never watched a political debate in my entire life.
We read about it. We read all about it. But you did. Yeah, but tell us.
It wasn't easy. And believe me, it was not easy at all. But the thing I want to bring up is what he said was, how he had addressed that was, for both questions, public employee compensation. So I just want to say to all the teachers, police, firemen, municipality workers out there who plan on voting for this multimillionaire who thinks you're overpaid, you better think again, because you're not.
Well, that is very, very important, because yeah. One of the things that the Republicans have done is to put all public employees in their, gun sites, in their, what's another word?
Within their reach.
Well, what you said,
control.
Matt, they're about knocking down salaries, and it's twofold, Matt. One is that they are just sort of characterologically committed to making, destroying the middle class for some reason or other. I mean, mostly because then it's about distribution of wealth. They get more and more money. But the other thing is that most public employees are members of what?
Unions.
Right. And what do unions do? Back the Democratic Party. So when they start their whole support, like for charter schools and like that Waiting for Superman documentary and all that, it's all about destroying the wage structure of the public middle class public employees, and ultimately about destroying the financial and electoral base of the Democratic Party.
That's, I know, and these people are going to vote for him. It's mind-boggling.
It is. All right, thank you very much. Appreciate your call. Isn't there a single person listening that went to this rally? I know people. Maybe they're not.
I know people. I should have just lined it up to have them call.
Yeah, we should have. Oh, you know, one of the things I wanted.
There are no matches on Snopes for hot rods taken away.
Yeah? Yeah. Okay.
If anyone knows anything about this, I'm actually curious about what this person was talking about.
All of these things.
This conspiracy, this one came out of nowhere, Peter.
Well, I just got, I don't know, probably too complicated even to talk about, but it was one of these anti-Muslim things. And someone I know sent me this, and said, this, you know, Muslim was closing their doors on September 11th to honor one of the 9/11 hijackers.
Oh, come on.
Yeah. So I went to Snopes.com. That's Snopes.com, which is anytime you get one of these emails, it passes on to everybody. And it's something so outrageous about a member of our community, of some ethnic group. Oftentimes when it'll say, I can't even remember this commentator. What was it? One of the commentators on 60 Minutes, Rooney.
Oh, Andy Rooney.
Yeah, not Mickey.
Right.
Andy Rooney, George Carlin. As soon as I see that, and it's a little teeny bit shaky, I always check it with Snopes. And, like, my record on this is 100% that and I realize these are forgeries.
I couldn't find the hot rods.
Yeah. So one of the things is that the government is always going to, somehow or other deprive us of fill in the blank, right?
Guns.
Yeah.
We get that.
And
take away your guns.
And no one is politically active till someone says, they're going to take away my hot rod. Doesn't matter that there's wars going on or that, the middle class
it's
is being eviscerated. Yeah. You're going to take away your hot rod. All right.
I've heard it all.
Oh, I like this. Foster from Madison Township. Hi, you're on the air. You want to say something positive? Great. Are you with us?
Hello?
Hello,
hi.
You're on the air.
Oh, great. How you doing?
We're doing good.
Okay. Hey, I just got one comment. I love the show.
Good.
And where were all these Tea Partiers and Sarah Palin when Bush was running the country into the ground like he has? I mean, nobody.
They were not paying attention. They were not paying attention. I'm telling you, they didn't even care.
Yeah.
They sure didn't.
And they want to get
my opinion.
And they want to get
racial with the way they've attacked President Obama.
They are. There's a high percentage of racism involved in this.
You just think because it's just a whole bunch of white people that.
It is. It's a bunch of crazy white people.
Well.
Peter and I resigned. Peter and I resigned from the white race a long time ago. So
in the interest of humanity.
In the interest of humanity. That's right, Peter. Thank you. That's the tagline is good.
But they won't admit it.
You did point out a lot of positives with this. I mean, a lot of people that don't have health insurance have a chance to get health insurance.
That's right.
The banks, I mean, the tax on the rich is it's causing them to get mad. They don't like being taxed. They for one thing, and that's what his main thing is. It's like it's time to start taxing them and stop taxing the middle class.
Well, Foster, it's not even that he's putting on this onerous tax on them. He wants to go back to what the tax was before Bush ruined the economy. That's all. And these are guys, think about these Koch brothers, K-O-C-H, that are multi-billionaires that are funding this teabagger movement, even to the point where they are bringing, when Glenn Beck had that rally, financed with hundreds of thousands of dollars, buses, right, and hotel rooms, and what have you, so they can get taxed less. I mean, wouldn't you think that they would think, tax me all you want, because you know what? It doesn't matter, because I'm a multi-billionaire, and I could still give all this money to Lincoln Center and what have you. They really are pathological. There's something truly...
The wires are crossed.
The wires are crossed. I mean, I think the compassion factor is riding... the needle there is right around zero.
Yeah. That's true.
All right. Well, thank you, Foster.
Thank you.
Hey, where's Madison Township, anyway?
No, it's Madison Heights.
Oh, I was wondering. I never heard of that. Yeah, Madison, Mad Heights. I know where that is. All right. Thank you.
Have a good night.
You too. Bye now. All right. We may have run this out because right now there's all open lines. So I'm going to reset some of this. But in the meantime, if you'd like to comment more, either on the rally that occurred in Washington, the rally to restore sanity
and fear.
And right now, according to CBS, 215,000 people showed up for the rally. By comparison, CBS estimated that about 87,000, just 40% of the sanity rally estimate, attended Glenn Beck's Restoring Honor. But I'm saying that this smaller one with this very, very dedicated, organized group of teabaggers may be able to have more impact than a much larger group.
Yeah, I don't. Yesterday's rally was not about creating big change. It was about
should have been.
Old Big Ed Schultz had one that was pretty large. No one's talking about that. What about size in comparison to that? Remember that? About a month ago?
Sure.
Yeah,
sure.
That was huge.
I mentioned this early in August. CNN poll found that only 2% of Americans consider themselves active members of the teabaggers. But in Frank Rich's column today in the New York Times, the grand old plot against the Tea Party, where he's talking about that the teabaggers essentially are just cannon fodder for the ultra-billionaires that are behind it all, Karl Rove and the rest. In his column, Frank Rich says that result was confirmed last weekend by the Washington Post, which published the fruits of its months-long effort to contact every Tea Party group in the country. To this end, it enlisted the help of Tea Party Patriots, the only Tea Party umbrella group that actually can claim to be a spontaneous, bottom-up grassroots organization rather than a front for the same old fat cats of their Republican right, from the Koch brothers to Dick Armey's Freedom Works.
That's a sign we need to get those commercials in, Peter.
Let me get this, and I can do it. Give the phone number.
Okay, 313-298-WRIF, 313-298-9743. Peter.
Tea Party Patriots has claimed anywhere from 2,300 to nearly 3,000 local affiliates, but even with its assistance, the Post could verify a total of only 647 Tea Party groups nationwide. Most had fewer than 50 members. The median amount of money each group had raised in 2010 was $800, nowhere near the entry fee for the Republican Country Club. So if you said to me, the Democrats have really failed, I would say, well, let me do this, and we'll be right back.
You're listening to Night Call with Peter Werby and Julene Jordan on 101 WRIF
Peter and Julene are taking your calls at 313-298-WRIF.
That's what we do.
We'll be taking more of your calls right after this.
He ran for state office and was beaten. Started a business and failed. Ran for Congress and lost. But thankfully, Abraham Lincoln didn't give up. Perseverance. Pass it on. A message from the Foundation for a Better Life.
WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit. We're back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF. Voice your opinion at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Here are Peter and Julie.
All right, here's what it's all about. Right, eat the rich. They're eating us, folks. The middle class has lost over 23% of its relative share of wealth of this nation, and it didn't get lost in the laundry, right?
Mm-hmm.
It went to somebody else's hands. Well, it didn't go to the poor people. It didn't go to the working class. It went up. That's who got it. This is a system that's always been based on looting. And when we can put some brakes on the people that are behind the most excessive looting, we, the average person, does okay. Now it's all beginning to fray. Now get this. Currently, 85%, Currently, 85% of America's wealth, which is defined as total assets minus total liabilities, is held by the country's richest 20%. So the top 20% of this country owns 85% of everything. Meanwhile, the upper middle class holds 11%, the middle class has 4%, the lower class and poor share an anemic 0.3%. So the Karl Rove's of the world, this is what they want to maintain. Now, the teabaggers, which are in the main upper middle class and middle class, they have often, as they did in Europe, fascist parties in Europe, had great resentments for the ultra-rich, what they call the big bourgeoisie, in French, which was used over there. Yet they wound up being the tools for the ultra-rich by putting in these fascist parties that defended the wealth of the upper classes against the working class that was demanding anything from revolution to just a fairer economy. You get an idea here. Wealthy U.S. investors feel better about their financial matters than they did a year ago. You'll be glad to know that. I mean, hey, everybody isn't down. Everybody isn't down. There's houses in Jolene and my neighborhood that are being foreclosed, and those people feel pretty badly. And I'm a little worried. I'm a little worried about what's happening in our neighborhood.
Yeah, right.
But the wealthy U.S. investors feel better about their financial matters than they did a year ago.
I am surprised. A couple of houses up and down my block have sold.
No, they will.
But I'm sure at a very, very, very low price.
Yeah. Some 40% of Americans with at least $250,000 of investable assets say their finances are in better shape than last year, with 37% reporting no change. So 78% of Richie Rich Kid is doing okay.
Yep.
So that's what it is all about. All right. Let's get some more of you on the air. Peter Werby and Jalene Jordan, 313-298-WRIF.
313-298-9743.
And let's see, here is Dustin. He's in Gaines, Michigan. Hi, Dustin. You're on the air.
Hey, how's it going?
Going good.
Yeah. Hi, long time listener. Love your guys' show.
Well, thank you.
I'm just curious. You guys were talking about taxes earlier. What do you guys think of flat taxes? Because I think we shouldn't single out one particular group and tax the hell out of them because they got a bunch of money.
Why not?
Peter, it's all you.
Why not? They can afford it.
Really, it's not fair. I know we're the middle class getting taxed pretty bad. They were the higher percentage, but I just don't think it's fair. But I believe flat taxes would solve a lot of problems.
Well, I don't think flat taxes would solve anything. As far as I'm concerned, there shouldn't be any taxes with a family making $50,000 or more. So what we should have is a tax deduction right off the top of $50,000. No, so I mean, if you make $55,000, you're paying taxes on $5,000. Then there's a heavily graduated, steeply graduated tax to it. Doesn't allow these tremendous impacted fortunes that mostly what they do is, for one thing, it hurts the economy because it's not being put back into the economy, but also it allows people to buy the system the way these Koch brothers and these other members of the Chamber of Commerce are distorting this election that's coming up. And in a way, we all do play a flat tax. I think what it is about 25% when you factor in all the taxes, right? So it would mean a diminishing amount of tax for the wealthy. As far as I'm concerned, once somebody gets over 5 million, as long as we're still in a deficit economy, as soon as the country has this huge debt, that why don't we have any income over 5 million or any amount of wealth that is accumulated be taxed at 90%? What would be the social harm in that?
I mean, I'm not no expert, but I just call and see what your guys' opinion is on that. That's 80% of the person's wealth. I mean, maybe they want to put some back for their kids and kids beyond that.
Well, wait. They'd have millions and millions and millions. Buffett. What's Buffett's
name? Warren.
Warren Buffett said that if they took away, he's a multi-billionaire, second richest man in the world, just below Bill Gates. He said if they took away 99% of his wealth, that his lifestyle, which would I assume would include what he wants to do for his children, wouldn't affect him in the slightest. So this is money that just remains in this. It actually doesn't circulate within the economy to the extent that it could if it was redistributed. I mean, it's been redistributed. The wealth that once was part of the middle class and middle class expectations and high wages of working class people now is increasingly gone to the high side. These guys have nowhere to spend it because they've accumulated every possible commodity, every little toy and trinket and vacation place and car and what have you. So they put it in stocks, and then they speculate with it, which is one of the things that that created this financial collapse in the first place. All right, thank you very much. Appreciate your call. Wait a minute. Here is one. Hot rods. Here's Rob in Farmington Hills. Rob, hi. You're
Please.
On the air. What's up?
Enlighten me.
What's up with that?
I've got the December 2010 issue of Hot Rod, which has on the cover, it says, "Can they outlaw hot rodding?"
Okay.
And it talks about how they want to outlaw any kind of hot rod, that's including four-wheel drive vehicles, classic cars, anything that's customized, you know, maybe a muffler or something like that would be considered a hot rod. And they want to outlaw it because even though it's bringing in $73 billion a year, they want to outlaw it.
What's
why?
It?
Why?
What's the it here? It's bringing in. What do you mean it's?
The industry, right?
Yeah,
but why do they want to outlaw it?
Well,
I want to know.
I think it's emission control. That's Mike from Milford's on the...
That's what I thought it was.
Yeah. I used to be able to get more people on the line.
Autorama. That's like one of the coolest car shows out there.
Yeah.
Yeah. And
I love that.
They're trying to say that they want to get rid of it all because of... Some of it's because of emissions, but a lot of it... They're coming out with new engines that they can put in old cars that are completely emissions compliant.
Oh, right.
Wait. Hold on. I want to see if I can get Mike on the air as well because he had a comment. I want to see if I can get both of you on the air. Mike, are you with us too? Hey, Mike from Milford. Mike, I actually hear him rustling around there. Hey, Mike. Listen up, buddy. Maybe we can't. We could do it. I think I got the technology down. But anyway, I don't know. I mean, I'd have to see more on that. I mean, sometimes people have wrong-headed ideas about things. I mean,
it's kind of like an NRA magazine. Well, during the Obama election, they're going to take away your guns. I don't know.
There's a difference between, Hummers And a hot rod, which is the person that brought it up, was saying is both creative, Adrian, I think it was, that is both creative in terms of what people have done to restore it or customized it,
yeah.
And also a whole sport based around quarter-mile drag racing.
Right.
And, yeah, we do admittedly have a problem with air pollution and importation of oil, right?
Yeah.
Hey, Mike, are you on the air, too? Hey, Mike.
No, this is Rob.
I know, but I'm trying to see if I can raise. All right.
Peter, you're over your head here. You're
yeah, no. He's just not. All right, wait a minute.
You put him back on hold?
Rob, hold on. I'm going to put you both back on hold. All right. And then I'm going to get him back on, so we'll continue. All right. You're back on the air.
He didn't put the other one on hold.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's a part in here. It says that for the most part, hot rodding and general tinkering around with cars, be they rods, customs, sport cars, 4x4s, you name it, has become a familiar, friendly hobby. And it's also a $32 billion contributor to our nation's economy annually. Thanks to all the parts and service produced for the hobby cars. Yet car enthusiasts of all stripes are still under attack. As cars and society have become more complex, so are the laws that govern them.
Well,
interesting. Yeah. What would Jay Leno do? He's got warehouses full of these suckers.
on one hand, of course, there's been all sorts of restrictions on cars over the years in terms of pollution and controls and what have you. And they've made for a much, much cleaner atmosphere. So there's two aspects of this. One is the general the general class of automobiles that should have demands on it as high a fuel mileage that is possible technologically. On the other hand, hobbyists obviously ought to be free from that. So
yeah,
I would agree.
So it's vintage. So it's original,
yeah.
Right?
All right. Thank you very much. Appreciate you clearing that up.
We're on your hot rod folks side.
Yeah. I want to see. Okay. All right. Just had to make some.
Yeah.
Hey, this is good. Here's Greg from Peacenik. I was out at the Phoenix Cafe on Saturday.
I had to work.
Yeah. Hey, Greg, welcome back to the show. Tell people about your event. You had we had a little watching party of the rally in Washington, and then it wasn't many people there when I was there. Did more people finally show up?
Well, for the music later on that evening, a lot more came.
It always happens.
People love
like
the music.
Yeah.
Right. That's why the cornerstone of Peacenik is to put together musical rallies, because it does draw people. So we just have to maybe combine the event where there's some action going on in the back, speaking and talking and things like that, so we can, have a bigger crowd.
You know, a lot of people probably were just watching that at home, too. Maybe they wanted to watch it uninterrupted or, without the crowd.
Yeah.
We did have a discussion afterwards with the small group that was there, and we basically agreed with you, Julene, that it was very entertaining. We laughed. It was funny. It felt good. But then about 2.5 hours into it, we all came to the same feeling that, something's lacking, though.
Mm-hmm.
And there's some substance. And he did give us that 5-minute speech, which was very good.
Like real activism. It was lacking real activism. Is that what you're saying?
Like, what do we do now? What's the next step, and how do we move forward?
You know what? That's what I say after every rally that I go to. I got to be honest.
Well, people always say, people that have organized big demonstrations, they always say that the rally, the most important part of the rally is the day after. What's left? And I'll tell you, the teabaggers, they're like a dog on a bone. They're ready to go. They're organized. They're doing stuff. And I think that it was just like in the wind.
I had a wonderful
time.
Well,
that's good.
What the first part I loved most of all. I'm not going to say it. I can't bash any more musicians on the show tonight.
Hey, they even had Kid Rock. Can you believe Kid Rock was there? Oh, that's what you didn't want to.
That was a little surprise.
Yeah, but he was
singing about being a moderate. So I think that's how he was.
But, you know, and that's what I think was wrong-headed, and I think Jon Stewart, to some extent, played into that. And, I mean, Sheryl Crow, she sang the duet with...
Well, she can wail.
Yeah, she sang the duet with Kid Rock, and they were essentially saying, you know, I'm sort of buffeted...
They're saying, I can't stop the war. This is this new song Kid Rock wrote. I can't stop the wars. I can't do this. I can't feed the poor. But you know what? That... I hate to say this, especially on this radio station, because I do love Kid Rock for what he's done for the city of Detroit.
Yeah.
I think he's a talented guy. I really do. And but I just felt like he was kind of thwarting any type of personal political action or political action, basically saying we can't do anything.
Yeah, it was.
That's how I felt.
Yeah, you know, remember the Obama slogan? He was saying, no, we can't, if you think about it. And
yeah.
I'll tell you what, though, Greg and Jalene and the rest of you listening, that his sentiment, I'm sure, probably represented that of
many people. That's going to be a huge hit.
That they think that the elite control things to such an extent that the average person is powerless. And I'll tell you, I mean, you look through American history, and it's always felt like that to the activists. The slacktivists, I guess what they did call them, the slacktivists, the slackers, who just say, oh, you know, nothing we can do, and they got it, you know, they got it, a vice grip on it all. They do have a vice grip on it. But there are moments in American history and in world history where the people have spoken and changed the whole nature of the world or their country or whatever. So, yes, we can.
Yeah, we just need to keep pushing.
All right, and you can go to Peace Nick, that's NICK, peacenick.org, and see what Greg's group is all about. And congratulations to you. Good work.
Thank you, Peter, and thank you for your support.
Sure, glad to do it, Greg. Bye-bye. And WWJ did a nice feature on efforts.
That's great.
All right, here is Fred in Detroit. Hi, Fred. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Hello, Peter. Jalene.
Hi.
I have a comment for the guy in Madison Heights. The teabaggers, the reason why they missed out on protesting Bush is that they were too busy riding one of the many bubbles we've been having in the economy over the years.
Sure.
And this comes from Reagan's budget director. Now, he happened to be on 60 Minutes tonight. And he was talking about this outrageous lie that both sides are telling. But he especially came down hard on the Republicans, who are always talking about cutting taxes. He said, cut taxes where?
Yeah.
And then Leslie Stahl, she interviewed Bill Gates' father, and they talked about...
Who's a cool guy.
Yeah.
...that they should pay a lot more in taxes. And Bill Gates is for this, even though he was CEO, I think it's his president, who's against it, the guy who's actually running Microsoft.
Well, Bill Gates Sr., isn't
that? Yeah.
Right.
He belongs to this group called Responsible Wealth, and whenever people like Bush would give him a tax cut, he would take that difference that he made, and he would donate it to socially responsible causes.
Yeah. How about that?
Well, she talked to some other business people around the Washington State, and she courted one guy who decided he would rather leave the state than pay any state taxes. And she said, where will you go? 44, 45 states in the union pay taxes. He rattled off six, including Michigan. And she said, well, four of them, pay taxes.
Sure.
So, you know, he tried to put up a defense, and like the guy said, the caller you had a couple of callers ago said, well, that's not fair. Bill Gates didn't have to pay taxes on his money, but he wasn't thinking about the times in which we live now. It doesn't matter what Bill Gates could or couldn't do then. It's what's happening now.
Well, I just don't understand. I got to tell you, Fred, why ordinary people are so protective of the ultra wealth of people that can't even use it. I mean, usually when people like you or me, we think about we get another $1,000 or another $10,000. I mean, think about if you got like a job and all of a sudden got a $30,000 raise. I mean, man, I mean, wouldn't you or me just think, wow, I can get and fill in the blank. Maybe get a different house or maybe get a nicer car or maybe, say, you know, put it in the bank for your kids, something like that. I mean, to have billions and billions and then fight to like some of these richies do, to keep people from forming unions so they can get better wages or to stop regulation on your corporations so they can pollute more so you can get more money, so you can get more money, more billions. I mean, it is just pathological. There's no other explanation.
Yeah, and as a percentage, they let rich people never really pay that much anyway.
They don't. Yeah. But, you know what we say, eat the rich. They're eating us. That's where they're getting money from. All right, Fred, thanks for calling 313-298-WRIF. Some phone lines opening up, and not a single on-the-ground report from the rally yesterday in Washington, D.C.
Maybe they're not back yet.
Maybe they're not back. Yeah. Maybe they went to sleep.
Maybe they decided to stay and do a little touristy stuff.
I want to welcome a caller. It's who I think it is. I haven't heard from him in years. Carl in Detroit.
This is Carl from Detroit.
Carl.
But what I'm pleased to talk with you. I'll tell you what I would like for you to do.
What's that, Carl?
Talk more about the Supreme Court and all these bastards. They've got the five that's on there now like to change we the people to we the corporation.
Yeah.
And
they're doing a good job of it, Carl.
But you, I just don't hear you speak, about it.
Well, talk about the realm of the possible. I think that's these aren't races that are really raising the needle for most of the listeners here. And it should, because these are the men and women who are going to determine whether the laws of the state are constitutional or not. And there's a great move on the part of right-wing Republicans to reelect some, get others in there.
They already got five. What, they don't need a couple more. Some are getting rather old on the Supreme Court.
Well, who are you going to vote for, Carl?
Well, I'm going to vote for Obama, the straight Democratic.
Oh, okay.
Okay. Thank you very much.
All right, Carl. Carl is a longtime listener, and he actually writes letters.
I remember Carl from like 12 years ago.
Carl,
I remember his letters.
Yeah, and
hey,
he still
Carl.
Writes. And I haven't even mentioned my website. If you want to find out wherever to... Actually, I had a little... I had another letter here somewhere.
PeterWerby.com.
Yeah.
You go to Peter Werby.
Oh, yeah. And on there, at PeterWerby.com. W-E-R-B-E. We forgot completely as well about our Facebook page. Why? Because we've been finally starting to really pump it up, make it very interactive. Thank you to you, Jalene.
Thank you to me.
And to Debbie. And to Stephanie. Right?
Yes. In fact, go to facebook.com/nightcall. We're posting things. It's actually it's happening. I've been promising for a year. Debbie's kept this thing going.
Yeah. Chris writes into, you can see this right at facebook.com/nightcall. Chris writes, hi guys, you were talking about Ted Nugent, but I was driving home from work, so I couldn't respond. Ted is an outdoor show, has an outdoor show, and he did a commercial about getting out and voting, even though he didn't care who you voted for, just get out and vote. And then at the
he
end
cares.
Of it, he said, soldiers have died defending America and what America stands for. And to hug a deceased soldier's mother at the end. To me, he was telling people to vote for the repukes.
Of course he was.
The Chicken
You're
Hawk
right.
Party.
Yep.
That's what it says. Yeah, so friends wanted. And it's facebook.com/nightcall, my site, Peter Werby.
Yeah.
PeterWerby.
In fact, I'm going to get on there right now because there are, and as we go along, there are a couple things that I wanted to mention that I said I was going to talk about on the air because that's all part of it.
Oh, yeah.
If you comment on the Facebook page, we'll bring some of that up on the air.
And this week's guest, Rich Benjamin, who's the author of Searching for Whitetopia, An Improbable Journey to the Heart of White America. And Dr. Daniel J. Carlett. Unhinged, The Trouble with Psychiatry, A Doctor's Revelations About a Profession in Crisis. And that's coming up at 1 a.m., so just about a half hour, a little more than a half an hour. Got time to take your calls as well at 313-298-WRIF. And here is Ed in Bloomfield Township. Hi, Ed. You're on the air.
Good evening, Peter and Julian.
Hi.
Hello.
Hey, what I wanted to bring up real quick with the election here coming up Tuesday is I mainly vote third party, and I hear a lot of negative criticism when I mention it to people when I talk politics, like, well, they're never going to win, and it's just kind of a wasted vote. But I tell you, you really shake up the Democrats, Republicans, if we could bring the numbers up voting third party. And I mainly liked what the Libertarians and Natural Law Party stands for, but I just want to encourage people, if you're not satisfied, for example, with, Schneider and Bonero, get out, look at Ken Proctor's stance with Libertarian or, you know, the Green Party. Let your voice be heard, and don't let your vote be swayed about if they're going to win or lose. There are some great candidates on the third-party ticket, and I would encourage people to look that route if you're not satisfied with your Democrats or Republicans.
Well, vote with your heart.
I'll tell you, Ed, when I was out at the Phoenix Cafe in Hazel Park yesterday, Saturday, where the group Peace Nick had a viewing of the rally in Washington, there was some literature there from the Green Party. And in my district, Julia Williams for U.S. Congress, and there's old Sander Levin there's a leaflet about him that he accepted over $100,000 from what she calls the candidate of the Green Party, dirty energy money. So it's DTE Energy and USX Corporation Oil, American Gas Association, XL Energy, Coal Alliance.
Well, Peter,
Energy.
What's he going to do, say no?
Yeah, so here's the point, though. So it's always about blackmail. And I say this all the time, and that's exactly what you're talking about, Ed. So if I say to somebody this guy Sander Levin is just, too bad. He's awful on the war. He votes for every single military appropriation, on and on and on like that. And they say, well, you don't want the Republican to get in, do you? And I'm thinking, no, I don't want the Republican to get in at all. But so you're continuing on the same Ferris wheel forever, or merry-go-round, whichever. Just around and around and around and around, right? So
yep.
I still have not decided. You know what? I don't think I'm going to vote for Sandy Levin. I think I'm going to vote for Julia Williams.
You've been saying that for weeks.
Yeah,
you think you've been saying you weren't going to. Are you waffling?
I'm waffling.
Let's see. On Facebook,
thank
real
you,
quick,
Ed.
Peter, here's one thing that Chris Williams, one of our
I just read his
fans, did you... Oh, on the air?
Yeah.
We need for the whole country to discuss our crumbling infrastructure?
Well, I think it's the same guy.
Oh, and why the business corporate community needs to pay their part, because people need to understand that our infrastructure serves the whole country, and that's why it's so important. Someone else, Keith Smith, wanted to talk about Don't Ask, Don't Tell. Is it over, back on? He's not sure what's going on with that.
This court, I think, had a stay of the order that overturned the Army prohibition against gays serving in the military. So
he also wants to know what you think about, do you think Elizabeth Warren's new post will be impressive in name and speech only, or will she have the actual power to throw down the gauntlet and make the banksters toe the line?
The banksters toe the line. The banksters draw the line. Don't they?
Yeah, that's right. A good answer. There you go, Keith.
Here's Mike in Clarkston. Mike, hi. You're on the air. Welcome.
Peter, hello.
Hi.
Hey, listen, do you know, I was wondering if you knew that radio talk show host, the Christian evangelical Bob Duco?
Oh, yeah. He and I get dinner all the time together.
Oh, you do not.
No,
people have tried to get you to go up against him. Isn't that the guy?
Yeah. No, I don't. I've never even heard him. But they're always saying they want me to debate him about belief in God, because he apparently always...
Yeah. Well, yeah, I'm kind of wondering what he's really political, and he was saying on his radio show last week that conservative views and conservative ways benefit the working class more than the liberal ways.
Well, that's what they always say. What are they going to say? Our program is for the ultra-rich, and if you vote for us, we'll just get Richie Rich Kid more money. Well, no one's going to vote for that, but, I mean, that's essentially what will be happening, right?
So, yeah. Myself, you know, I'm a liberal. I vote Obama and, you know, the Democrat all the way. But this guy just irritates me when he comes off and says something like that. And I've been laid off for 8 months. I finally got called back to work.
Good.
And the Republicans want to cut off unemployment and everything else. And how are they helping us?
No, they're not at all. But, I mean, and there's a lot of them. A lot of these teabagger candidates, including Joe Miller in Alaska, that says the minimum wage is unconstitutional. Some of them say, I mean, what are some of the other? Oh, yeah, that there shouldn't be any Department of Education, so there shouldn't be any kind of federal grants to help local schools, on and on and on. The only people that are going to be helped by Republican programs are the ultra-rich. I mean, it's
another thing that worries me is, you know, I'm 56. I want to retire when I'm 62. I'm in the Teamsters. Now, what if this Boehner guy wants to take unemployment or take retirement to 70?
Well, oh, yeah. Also, remember, a number of these guys want to abolish Social Security.
I know.
And you're pronouncing it wrong. It's Boehner.
Oh, okay, Boehner.
Peter Wormy.
It is. I mean, the reason, look at
it. Well, he's
a
total bonehead.
Yeah, but here, I always say this. You look at it, if you put an H instead of a B in front of his name, it would be what? Honer, the harmonica.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. He just wants to call himself Boehner because he doesn't want to be called a Boehner.
You're just ornery.
Yeah.
Hey, Peter, you know the comedian Elaine Boozler?
Sure.
She's a friend of mine on Facebook, okay? I love her. I think she is so funny.
Hold on, Mike. I want to say one more thing to you, but go ahead.
We're talking about the Bushes at the Rangers game tonight. She said, oh, my God, Barbara Bush is at the ball game dressed in a witch costume. Oh, wait. No, sorry. So, and I told her that I was going to give her credit on Detroit Radio for her little joke.
All right, here, Mike. You must be terminally bored if you're listening to somebody, some right-wing Christian nationalist.
Or maybe curious.
Well, I listen to him a lot because I listen to him on my way to work, and he's on from like 12 to 4. And I listen to him for about a half an hour, and that's usually what I get is his point on the news from a Christian point of view.
Well, you should be listening to WRIF, Rockin' with Meltdown. Hey, Meltdown, you listening? He listens coming back from hockey sometime. But
well, he says that he tries, but he has to turn us off because we drive him so crazy.
That's good. But, Mike, if you want to listen to talk radio and not the riff, try 1310 AM. You know that station?
Yeah, I listen to that, too. But I listen to this Duco guy because he pisses me off.
Oh, you like raising your blood pressure first thing in the morning.
I do. I've got dents in my dash from listening to this idiot.
I think you should stop. Give yourself at least maybe just do it once a week or something.
Thank you, Mike.
Quitting smoking.
Appreciate it. This guy, there's been a number of people that have tried to set me up with a debate with this guy who says, any terms. At first he wanted me to come on his show, and I'm thinking, oh, yeah, is he going to have a little bit of advantage or what, right? Then he said he would come on my show.
Yeah.
And then I'm thinking, oh, yeah, that's great, and I'll give his name.
Giving him free publicity.
Just saying his name now is free publicity. So
he's
not
allowed in the studio.
No, we've said his name about 5 times. How many times do you think he's said my name on the air?
A lot.
He has?
I bet.
I bet he hasn't.
I bet he has.
I hope you're right.
I hope I am.
All right. Ken from Ortonville, stick on the line. Some of the rest of you are on it as well. Some open lines as well.
It's our last half hour, so give a call.
And here are the numbers.
You're listening to Night Call with Peter Werby and Jalene Jordan on 101 WRIF. Let your opinion be heard. Call us at 313-298-WRIF.
Whatever's going on, it seems to be far from over.
Peter and Jalene will be taking more of your calls right after this.
Time's running out. You're maxed out on your credit cards. The collection calls are coming every day, and now you're 2 payments behind on your mortgage. Every time you turn on the radio, there's some cheerful couple telling you how they got out of debt overnight. Their stress is gone, and everything's just wonderful. Come on. The truth is, what sounds too good to be true is too good to be true. You need real help, and you need it now. Not bankruptcy. That should be your last choice. We're Credit Card Relief, and we've been helping people just like you for nearly a decade. We're the attorney-driven program, dedicated to helping you get out of debt in months instead of years, saving you thousands, and without risking your family home. We know what we're doing, and we don't make promises we can't keep. The consultation is free, and the relief is real.
Get out of debt. Call Credit Card Relief at 866-290-8282. Not available in all states. That's Credit Card Relief. 866-290-8282. 866-290-8282. If you want a new computer but think you can't get credit, think again. Just call Tronics Country right now. No matter what your credit status is, now you can own a brand new desktop or laptop computer. Your approval is guaranteed, as long as you have an active checking account and can afford small weekly payments. With Tronics Country, there's no credit check. You will not be turned down. Call right now and order your new computer. You'll also get a free color printer and a free digital camera. Just call 800-990-2258. But that's not all. Call right now and you'll also get a free 22-inch high-definition TV with your paid purchase. You heard right. A free TV with your new computer. All you need is an active checking account and your approval is guaranteed. Don't wait. Call Tronics Country right now. Call 800-990-2258. That's 800-990-2258. 800-990-2258. Did you know the tap water in your home may be hazardous? Not to your health, but to your appliances and your wallet. Your home's hard water creates pipe clogging line scale, and that can shorten the life of your water heater, ruin your dishwasher, and break down your washing machine. Lime scale deposits block the heating element, and that could be costing you an extra $1,200 a year in energy and wear. But you can remove lime scale without chemicals, magnets, or salts. It's easy with HydraCare, the patented device used worldwide. See for yourself at bestsoftwater.com. You simply clip HydraCare to your main water pipe. HydraCare removes and prevents lime scale buildup in your entire plumbing system. If your home has hard water, extend the life of your appliances with HydraCare. Try it risk-free. Just go to bestsoftwater.com. That's bestsoftwater.com. Or call now, 888-883-8187. That's 888-883-8187.
101 WRIF.
Everything that rocks.
Water is all around us. No wonder it's hard to imagine we're facing a water crisis. But we are. So that's why the American Planning Association brings you simple ways to save water at home and in your community. Learn more at planning.org. That's planning.org. A public service message from this station and the American Planning Association.
101 WRIF.
Everything that rocks. This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Voice your opinion at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Now, here are Peter Werby and Julian Jordan.
And hey, we're back with our final segment at 1 a.m. Eastern Time. Rich Benjamin, author of Searching for Whitetopia, An Improbable Journey to the Heart of White America, and Dr. Daniel Carlett, Unhinged, The Trouble with Psychiatry.
Couple of emails,
yeah,
too, right?
Go ahead.
Barry from Port Huron writes, do you think that this first round of crazy teabaggers is a test run for the smarter, richer teabaggers that will be running during the next big election in 2012?
Sure. I mean, they're getting rid of the Sarah Palins. I mean, that's just like a sideshow. I hear from Don in Warren, writes into calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Peter and Julian, what I've seen going on is all the car publications are trying to increase fears about restrictions on modified cars. There has been no actual legislation proposed, so this just seems like them trying to get people up in arms and a way to increase their own organization's memberships.
Okay.
That's interesting. Yeah. I don't know more about it. We'll maybe some of you can comment on it. 313-298-WRIF. Here's Ken. He's in Ortonville. Hi, Ken. You're on the air.
Hey, Peter. Good talking to you.
Well, thanks.
Hey, I just wanted to talk. You had a guy called a little while ago about the flat tax.
Yeah.
I hear this argument a lot, and I heard your thing is, well, the rich people can afford to pay more.
Right.
I can take it further than that.
Go ahead.
I'd just like to go on a little rant of why the rich should pay more. First of all, we have a $700 billion defense budget. That main budget is mainly protecting the investments and interests of billionaires around the world.
Absolutely.
Let them pay for that budget. You know, I'm sick of paying for
directly.
It. Directly. Furthermore, we give money to foreign nations all over the place a lot of times to protect the investments and interests of billionaires. Let them pay for that money. A lot of the money they made is off of grants given to them from our government. So, like, the drug companies get the grant, they make a drug, then they sell it. They made money off of the money we gave them. So, yeah, they should pay more.
Ken, listen to this. Four nations with child soldiers keep U.S. aid. In 2009, the government of Chad conscripted refugee children for unlawful use as guards and combatants in its desert battles against rebel troops. The Army of the Democratic Republic of Congo forced children to carry ammunition and supplies through the jungle, and some died under their weight. Hundreds of boys and girls were forced into the Army of Southern Sudan despite a commitment to release them. And in Yemen, children as young as 14 make up perhaps half the ranks of both the government forces and the rebels opposing them. Despite those findings, in the annual State Department report on human trafficking, the Obama administration is allowing American military aid to continue to the four countries, issuing a waiver this week of a 2008 law, the Child Soldiers Prevention Act. In a memorandum to Secretary of State Hillary Rodham Clinton on Monday, President Obama said he determined that the waiver was in the national interest. So there you go. Well, you know what's going on here, of course. It's not, part of it is direct aid. Part of it is they buy our military products, right? That's the military-industrial complex at work. And we're paying for it.
Absolutely.
Yeah. All right. So sure, eat the rich. They're eating us. Thank you very much. Appreciate it. 313-298-WRIF. Here's Michelle in Farmington Hills. Hi, Michelle.
Hi, Peter. Hi, Jelaine.
Hi.
Hello.
Hello. Your voice is hanging in well, Jelaine.
Thank you. It's better. It's tough. When what you do for a living is rant and rant and rant, losing the voice is pretty scary.
Yeah, and you've got a night for ranting.
Yes, for sure.
But, yes, about the, I was going to say eat the rich and feed the poor.
Oh, hey.
Yeah, there you go.
Hey, love it.
Yeah, I love it. Yeah, you used to play that clip of that on your show, Peter.
Of the song?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, we still...
No.
Oh, a different one.
Oh, no, that's from...
Aerosmith.
Oh, well, there is an Eat the Rich by Aerosmith.
Yeah.
That's the one I'm thinking of, yeah.
But he doesn't say feed the poor in there, does he?
No, I don't... Probably not.
That's a line in I'd Like to Change the World by 10 Years After.
Thank you.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Something like that. Not quite like that, but...
Yeah.
Till there is no rich no more. And I don't know where he's coming from or not, whether he's complaining about it or he likes it.
Right. But you explained that very well about, you know, the anybody making over 5 million, these richy riches, you know, before when you explained that, I think everybody in America, you asked, you know, we always stick up for the rich people. That's because in America it's like everything's supposed to be fair and equally divided. These people just can't. They don't understand, like, the concept of all the money they have.
I think what I said last week, Michelle, that it is the Stockholm syndrome. These people's minds have been kidnapped, and they identify with the kidnapper. Like I said, what would be the social harm in essentially the government taking wealth earned that's over $5 million a year? How would anybody be harmed? I know what's how people are harmed by families who make $25,000
right.
a year. We know what happens with malnutrition and improper housing and bad schools and what have you. I mean, there is so much impacted wealth here that we could confiscate. I love to use that verb because that'll really set the conservatives off. Confiscate hundreds of billions of dollars of wealth. And that would still allow those same people to have the same social position that they had before the confiscation. So in that regard, nothing would change whatsoever.
For
that,
them, right.
Yeah. But the wealth question would change, but the political question would have to be addressed separately.
Right, right. Because it is, it's so unfair. And all these lower class people, I mean, they hardly can make ends meet. And, you know.
They can't. Many
right.
of them cannot.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
All right, Michelle. Thank you so,
so
much.
Sad. Peter.
Thank you for calling in.
Yeah, thanks, Michelle. Our buddy Winston Smith wrote in.
Yeah.
And he said, the insatiable mega rich are as addicted to money as any junkie is addicted to crack or smack. You and I can't understand it because we haven't mainlined major money. But if we did, we would get hooked too. Bottom line is there needs to be a war on money to control the situation. And the way to do it, Winston says, is to restore the 91% progressive tax rate.
Sure. Which would be like over $5 million is a 91% tax rate. And also,
sounds
that,
just like you, Peter.
And how about self-interest? So anyone who's thinking, and I always get these guys, why when everybody seems to be located downriver who objects to this. So here's the deal. If you make over $5 million on every dollar over that, it's a 91% tax. This would mean very easily that anyone may, that there would be a $50,000 tax deduction. So for the first $50,000 of your income, you would pay no tax whatsoever. So this would allow you thousands of dollars more a year. You oppose that? I don't get it. You're protecting the interest of the wealthy against your own self-interest. I don't understand that one bit.
Yeah,
you'll take away everyone's incentive. Yeah, for $5 million, I wouldn't get out of bed, right? By the way, and I want to thank, I didn't write his name down, in Georgia. My mind has, anyway, someone from Georgia sent this. 19 facts, I'm not going to read them all, about the deindustrialization of America that will blow your mind. The United States has lost approximately 42,000 factories since 2001. Dell Incorporated, one of America's largest manufacturers of computers, has announced plans to dramatically expand its operations in China with an investment of over $100 billion over the next decade. Dell has announced that it will be closing its last large U.S. manufacturing facility in Winston-Salem, North Carolina, in November this year. Approximately 900 jobs will be lost. Now, here is a real case for Eat the Rich. I can't remember the man's first name, Dell, who owns the company. Why are they going to China? It's solely because of labor costs. And you can imagine that they have to, there's all this shipping that's involved and all the administration.
And because they can.
Yeah. So they are counting on a wage structure that is so low that this will make them more money. So you say, well, you know, that's the deal. Capitalists are in business to maximize capital for themselves, in the case of this very, very wealthy entrepreneur, and for their shareholders. I'm not sure how this company is structured, whether they have public holdings or not, or whether it's just all owned by him. So what really has to happen, and what should have happened a long time ago, is there should have been laws immediately made that restricted companies from taking jobs overseas, that they were required to, for instance, if they wanted to do it, to pay some enormous tax, which would they would say, well, gee, we can't pay this because it would be unprofitable for us to leave the United States. So, again, if you're somebody that's thinking, well, gee, we don't have any right to do that, you're talking about the destruction of the American economy, or at least, I'm going to take that back. Because remember we were talking earlier about how the wealthy were saying, hey, things are looking up. Good portions of the investor class are saying things are doing pretty well. And yet down in the ranks of the people that really make this country go, it's not the rich fat cats, not even the big entrepreneurs or the CEOs, the ordinary man and woman goes to work every day and produces and, you know, writes the orders or does the engineering or turns the bolts or sweeps the streets or what have you. That's 90% of our population. But if you would have stopped that rate from the beginning, if the unions would have gone after the people that were beginning to outsource jobs to Mexico in the begin with, like the UAW, should have called a general strike in auto when that first happened. So you ain't going anywhere, or you're not going to have any plants operating. And if the UAW wouldn't have done it, then the government should have done it to say, you cannot leave this country. You are not going to destroy our economy for our workers and for our middle class. But you know what? Toothpaste is out of the tube, my friends. I'm not sure what we're going to do. Remember? Keep saying, thatch our roofs. Admit that we're peasants. So it's happening all around the world, too. In Mumbai, India, used to be Bombay. And where do we always call these the names of cities by something different what the people that live there call them? I mean, why do we call Roma Rome? Torino, why do we call it Turin?
Because we're Americans?
I don't know. Yeah. why do we call Germany Germany? They don't call it that. Where did this all come from?
I don't know.
What did they call it? Deutschland, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Why do we call France?
I don't know, Peter.
But here in Mumbai, formerly Bombay, the newest and most exclusive residential tower for this city's super rich is a cantilevered sheath of steel and glass soaring 27 stories into the sky. This is a residential tower.
Ooh.
The parking garage fills six levels. Three helipads are on the roof. There are terraces upon terraces, airborne swimming pools, and a hanging garden in a Blade Runner meets Babylon edifice overlooking India's most dynamic city. There are nine elevators, a spa, 50-seat theater, and a grand ballroom. Hundreds of servants and staff are expected to work inside. And now, finally, after years of planning and construction, the residents are about to move in. All five of them.
What?
All five of them. This is a home. This is a single home, this 27-story.
Oh, my.
30,000, well, there's some.
Oh, I did see something about that.
Some reports have estimated the total residential space at 400,000 feet, but people close to the project say it's only 60,000 square feet.
It's one family?
Yeah. It's the tower known as Antilia is the new home of India's richest person, Mukesh Ambani, whose $27 billion fortune also ranks him among the richest people in the world, and even here in the country's financial capital, where residents bear daily witness to the stark extremes of Indian wealth and poverty, Mr. Ambani's building is so spectacularly over the top that the city's already elastic boundaries of excess and disparity are being stretched to new dimensions. So, I mean, how can this person live with himself? The conditions in those cities where millions of people live in these Indian cities, including Mumbai, without any running water, no toilet facilities. They're washing their clothes in rivers that are spoiled by human waste and all of this. And this home, they estimate, costs $1 billion.
My gosh.
Yeah.
It was a rags-to-riches tycoon, this guy. And it says, two of the sons, Mukesh and Anil, inherited and divided the empire and have spent years feuding, including a nasty recent fight over natural gas rights. So look what money does to people.
Yeah. This is, I mean, again, how could you live with yourself? Who cares? All right, let's...
They heard there's a BMW service station inside the house.
Inside?
God.
How could you have a 30... What's the lowest estimate? 60,000 square feet home.
Here's one. Right down the street, Sushala Pawar admitted struggling to comprehend the difference in his life and her own. She cooks for a family in a nearby apartment, earning about $90 a month. She sleeps on the floor of the hallway after the family has gone to bed.
Yeah. Well, she ought to work harder.
Oh, geez.
That's what the teabaggers would say.
Yeah.
Here's Scott in Westland. Scott, hi. It's Peter and Jeline. You're on the air.
Hi, Pete. Hi, Jolene. I think I can shed some light on the hot rod issue, and also I have a little bit more about natural gas drilling. But first, I think that the main issue that, say, the EPA would have with hot rodders these days is lead. You know, for a lot of these customized engines, and this is the same problem with both NASCAR and even light planes, there are some piston engines that still run on leaded gasoline. So if you go into a gas station, sometimes you'll see a separate pump that says, quote, racing gasoline. Well, guess what? That's leaded gasoline.
Sure.
And now, I could talk for an hour about this if it was a chemistry class, but basically
Scott,
the lead allows you to run the engine at a higher RPM than you would otherwise generally. And so that's why a lot of custom, you know, racing enthusiasts still want to use lead and gasoline.
Well, sure, and it was good to get the lead out of the gasoline for the average driver. But even NASCAR, which seems kind of an excessive use of gasoline, to be sure, and the hot rods.
How dare you, Peter, say that in this town.
But it is such a small, infinitesimally small usage overall of gasoline. The biggest user in, and I know, Scott, you know this, who is the biggest user of gasoline in the world?
The U.S. government?
The Pentagon, yeah.
Oh, yeah, well.
Yeah, so that's where it's all about. Well, tell you, you know what, there's a listener named Mike who's very concerned about this gas drilling. So we got about a minute left. Give us some headlines on that.
The gas drilling is basically Gelman Science is in Ann Arbor. Gelman Science on Wagner Road in Ann Arbor had a scheme to get rid of toxic waste using a deep injection well. This was back in the 1970s and 80s. So guess what? The idea was, again, the same guarantee was made that it would pump it so deep that it would never come up. Well, guess what? It did. Hmm. And so you can probably get a lot of information about this on AnnArbor.com, the old Ann Arbor News website. But basically what happened is that obviously the stuff came back up. And there's a real nice park, Dolph Park, you know, on Wagner Road in Ann Arbor. Some of the lakes there that have been tested have found, you know, chemicals that are extraordinarily unique to the waste that they were pumping down there. And it also, I believe, shut down one of the pumps that Ann Arbor uses to serve their own water system. So, yes, so the same thing, you know, promise was made there that they would pump it so deep it would never come back up. And now Gelman Science doesn't exist in that form anymore. You know, they were sued, and this is an ongoing crisis now. This plume of toxic waste is making its way through the groundwater in that area. So,
nice.
Again, it's ancient history, and history is repeating itself.
Just like storing all of those that nuclear waste is safe, right, Peter?
That's right.
Yeah.
All right, Scott, thanks for the update. Appreciate it. And Stephanie, thank you for doing the hard work of sorting out who can get on the air. Always a task. Glad so many of you did. And, hey, the election is on Tuesday.
It'll be interesting to talk to you all on next Sunday.
And stay tuned for the interviews. Got a couple of good ones ahead.
This is Night Call.
Okay, do that.
Bye-bye.
On 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with more Night Call right after this. That's the sound of people throwing out their old dehumidifiers. They've replaced them with the energy-saving Wave Ventilation Unit. Wave Ventilation expels moisture, gases, and toxins trapped in your basement or crawl space and replaces it with drier, fresher air. The computerized Wave Ventilation requires no maintenance. There are no buckets to empty, no filters to change, and compared to a dehumidifier, it will save you hundreds of dollars a year in energy costs. One customer wrote,
I was stunned by the difference. I had had a dehumidifier for almost 20 years without ever getting rid of that musty smell. And now that smell is finally gone.
Wave can transform your home into a drier, healthier environment. Satisfaction guaranteed. Find out more about Wave Ventilation right now.
For free information, go to goodairnow.com. That's goodairnow.com. Or call 1-866-324-9481. That's 1-866-324-9481.
This is your Car Care Minute. With more folks taking driving vacations this year, the pros at the National Institute for Automotive Service Excellence offer the following tips to help you arrive at your destination safely. First, review your owner's manual and follow the recommended service schedules. Be certain to check the level and concentration of the cooling system. Check your tires for wear and pressure, and be sure your heating and air conditioning systems are operating efficiently. If you've been experiencing performance problems such as hard starts, rough idling, or stalling, now's the time to have your vehicle serviced by a certified automotive technician. It's extra insurance against an annoying breakdown while on vacation. Your Car Care Minute is a public service by this station and the National Institute for Automotive Service Excellence, ASE.com.
Detroit's Rock Station, 101, The Real Riff.
He ran for state office and was beaten. Started a business and failed. Ran for Congress and lost. But thankfully, Abraham Lincoln didn't give up. Perseverance. Pass it on. A message from the Foundation for a Better Life.
WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit.
Now, Night Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me, Peter Werby, with you. You know, we've been talking about race in this country for a very long time, maybe since, oh, I don't know what, 1492 or 1608. You know, at first, there were all these pesky people of color here in the land that the Europeans wanted, so that was a problem. And then in order to build the basic economy of the United States, slaves were imported from Africa, and most of the history, it's been everything from a bloody civil war to segregation in the KKK, the civil rights movement of the 1950s and 1960s, and yet race still continues to be a conversation in our political and social and oftentimes in our personal lives as well. Many of us, myself included, were delighted that we could elect a man of color to the presidency without a concern for it, although with many of us, myself included, it was a big concern. I was very happy to be able to cross this barrier. Yet these issues, unfortunately, aren't settled. They are in some ways. They're increasingly settled on a personal level. On an institutional level, well, maybe things are, hate to say this, getting worse. We shall see. Joining me for a conversation about this is Rich Benjamin. He's written the book, Searching for Whitetopia, An Improbable Journey into the Heart of White America. And Rich Benjamin is a senior fellow at Demos, a nonpartisan national think tank. It's based in New York City, where we're reaching him. His social and political commentary is featured in major newspapers nationwide. He's been on NPR and Fox Radio, and he holds a PhD from Stanford University. And Rich Benjamin is joining me from the Demos office in New York. Welcome to the Peter Werby Show.
Hi, Peter. Great to be here.
And we should say, for the sake of this book and describe you, which is still shows we haven't gotten beyond everything we're talking about, as a person of African ancestry or a black American or an African American, because you were searching for Whitetopia. Tell us what Whitetopia is.
Whitetopias are America's fastest growing white communities. A Whitetopia has three traits. The first is that it has posted more than 6% population growth since the year 2000. The second is that the majority of that growth is from white migrants. And the third is that a Whitetopia has a social charm, a pleasant look and feel to its residents.
And it's made up, obviously, by the name Whitetopia, which comes from the phrase utopia, the perfect idealized state of being the many social planners have dreamed of all white. Well, it sounds sort of like South Africa.
Not quite, at least not quite the historical South Africa.
Yeah. What differentiates it? You see that, I mean, this sort of gathering of the tribe of those of your European ancestry, removing themselves from a country that, according to the Census Bureau, by 2042, that so-called whites will no longer be in the majority.
Right. But historically, South Africa had an apartheid regime where segregation was enforced at the barrel of a gun. Here we have something very different. We have people wanting to live better lives and in some cases explicitly fleeing diversity and in other cases not aware that their lifestyle choices in some way contribute to a segregated nation.
Mm-hmm. Talk to us a little, Rich Benjamin, if you would, in the context of your book, Searching for Whitetopia, what I said in the introduction, whereas personal prejudices, that hatred that many whites exhibited during the awful years, say through the 1970s or 80s, has diminished considerably, particularly among young people, yet institutional what aspects of that remain?
Yes. On the one hand, I think our country has a lot to be proud of, and we should pat ourselves on the back that in the one generation from my parents to me, interpersonal race relations have greatly improved such that, at least to my experience, it's a pleasant country where people rarely insult one another to their face based on race-related reasons at all. However, we have institutional forces, i.e. the way markets behave, the regular decisions that local governments take, and even our national government, that allow this country to be as segregated residentially and educationally today as it was in 1970, which was before I was even born.
Mm-hmm. Well, of course, the Supreme Court held famously in 1954 that separate facilities are inherently unequal. Need they be, though? I mean, for instance, Malcolm X, he felt that, remember, he, at least through most of his life, he didn't want to be a integrationist. He wanted to improve black communities. And, of course, there are many all-black communities that are, you know, have the same schools and economic situations as so-called white ones.
I don't know as a philosophical matter whether separate is equal, whether separate communities need be unequal. I just know that as a practical matter in this country, separate communities are not equal.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, we can see that. Well, all we have to do is there's one thin line. There is Detroit, Michigan, and you look at its school and its jobless rates, and there's a thin line, imaginary line drawn on a map, and then there's Grosse Pointe. And I think everybody knows, even people are listening out of town, what Grosse Pointe is. It's a wealthy, virtually all-white suburb of Detroit that has beautiful homes, great schools and what have you. So they're, but that seems to be something more rooted in policy than in attitude. And I think that's what you're getting at, right?
In part. I think the attitude part is that if you take features that many Americans associate with a first-rate community, i.e. high property values, comfort, safety, friendliness, many white Americans, without even giving it a second thought, associate those qualities with whiteness. And so when they see these neighborhoods, they just automatically assume they'll be white. Mm-hmm. So it's not as though they say, okay, I'm going to go be around other white people. These qualities are often interchangeable with white neighborhoods in their mind. And so that's one of the fascinating lessons I discovered on this journey, is that how one has segregation without white flight, as it happened historically in this country.
Well, as you may know about Detroit, beginning in the 1950s, there was out-migration of white people to the point now where the city is probably 85% or more African-American, and the population has been reduced from 2 million to probably under 800,000. And now African-Americans are leaving Detroit as well because of the bad schools, because of the lack of safety, because of low property values. So it's everybody is abandoning the ship.
Yes, yes, yes. And I think that's so unfortunate. I mean, I'm not one to have a soapbox, but what some of Detroit's recent leadership has done has really been a disservice to all races who live in that area. Whereas if you have a Denver, you know, their black mayor and their recent white mayor have done lovely things to the city, such as in some cases there's in-migration to Denver. So if you were to compare Detroit to Denver, what would you have? But yes, I agree with you. There has been white flight in Michigan in the past two decades, and Michigan itself has some white copian counties.
Like what? Tell us a few.
Benzie County, Livingston County,
mm-hmm.
is one in Michigan. Another is Lapeer County, Ottawa County, Becker County. Are counties in Michigan that qualify as Whitetopia.
Let me introduce you in your book again. My guest is Rich Benjamin. You're listening to the Peter Werby Show, and the book is Searching for Whitetopia. This is where whites gather in increasing numbers to have community. The subtitle is An Improbable Journey for the Heart of White America. And Rich Benjamin, you were naming off some counties, most of which I'm familiar with and have been to. Just from their racial content you can get from the U.S. Census Bureau? Is that where you can tell these definitions?
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
I can tell from the Census Bureau that the counties I just named have grown by more than 6%, and the majority of that growth has been white migrants. And those counties are at least 88% white in a nation and in a state that's nowhere near 88% white.
The implication is, though, that these people are racists, that they, and you answered that to some extent, that they want to go to a Whitetopia because they want to be around white people, and they don't want to be around African-Americans or Mexican-Americans or immigrants or even Asians. Are they racist? Because one of the things that I'm not doing, and this is my fault here as I interview you about searching for Whitetopia, the improbable journey in the heart of white America. We haven't spoken about your travels. So you've been in some of these communities in places like Idaho that's often called the hate state because of so many white racists, overtly white racists, Nazis and what have you, are up there. What was your experience? Were these people like virulent racists?
Oh, not at all. Not at all. In fact, in most of the Whitetopias I traveled, I was greeted warmly, and it made for a pleasant experience. I did a lot of bowling, a lot of golfing and hunting and fishing.
Yeah.
And so what the book illustrates is that most of these residents who've gone here have not at all gone explicitly for racial reasons.
Mm-hmm.
However, what the book does point out is in many of these communities, there's a lingering tension over other political issues, such as immigration and taxes.
Well, yeah, I mean, for one thing, it's so bizarre with how bad city services are in Detroit, and the taxes are high, and they even have a personal income tax. Now, as Rich Benjamin, as an African-American, I mean, if you, this is what's such a conundrum. You personally could either live in Detroit, where you'd have to have all sorts of alarms and you know, hire personal security, that some neighborhoods do, private security firms, not get any civil or city services. If you had kids, lousy schools. Yet there's a high proportion of people that you have an ethnic connection with or live in one of these Whitetopias that has high property values and good schools and lower taxes and what have you. What do you do?
Well, those are extreme choices. Most Americans aren't faced with that choice, Detroit or Whitopia. I think Detroit has had some severe problems that are more severe than other problems, or at least other places that the white migrants have left. So, for example, oftentimes white migrants are coming to Whitopia from places like Los Angeles County or Warren County or the inner suburbs of Washington, D.C., or New York or Chicago. And that's what's new about this book. Back in the 50s and in the 60s, there was white flight from inner cities like Detroit and Newark. But now we even see white flight from the inner suburbs to the exurbs and to small towns.
Mm-hmm. Now, when you traveled to, and in answering, maybe you could tell us about some of the individual incidences. And you said you were warmly greeted as a black man in these Whitopias. Well, why did you tell them you were there? Did you tell them you were researching a book on them?
I did. Everyone I knew, with a couple exceptions, knew that I was writing a book. And the exceptions were realtors. What I did was to pose as a home buyer in two of the communities wanting to buy a home. And the reason I did that is because realtors have their ears on the ground, and realtors understand communities with all their glories and warts better than most of us. And so that's a very thorough, very colorful way, pardon the expression, to understand a community, is to tag a realtor and to pretend you're a home buyer.
And what did you learn from them?
Oh, my goodness. I learned, A, all the considerations that go into buying a home. It helped focus why people buy a home. It helped me realize what qualities people look for, not only in the home, but in the neighborhood they're buying into. And then I learned about these Whitopian communities. For example, some realtors would say, well, you know, this neighborhood has a quality you may not like, i.e. it's older or younger. This neighborhood has XYZ church. So for me, that was one of the most fascinating and eye-popping experiences over my 27,000-mile journey, was tagging these realtors.
Wow, 27,000 miles, did you say?
Yes.
And you name some of the areas that you went. I remember in the book, I never had even heard of some of the cities, but they were like in the suburbs of Atlanta, the places I said in what's been called the hate state of Idaho. And so you've been everywhere.
Sure. I started out in St. George, Utah, and then I went to Coeur d'Alene, Idaho. And then the third community I immersed myself in over a long period of time was an exurb of Atlanta, an hour north, called Forsyth County, Georgia.
Mm-hmm. And when you say the longest time, I mean, did you live there or just?
I did. I lived there for 3.5 months. And in each case, with the exception of Coeur d'Alene, Idaho, I lived in a gated community.
Yeah. Could you get a cab?
There are no cabs to be had in Whitopia. And we laugh. But that's partly the point, is that these are car-based communities and there is no public transportation. And public transportation is a really, let's say, sticky, hot potato in Forsyth County, because one of the ways you can maintain segregation is to forbid public transportation. So Forsyth County has drawn a line in the sand, and they do not want the metro transportation extending from Atlanta to Forsyth. And every few years, that issue will come up. So no, there are no train stops and there are no cabs.
Well, and let me say again, because sometimes people are just joining us. My guest on the Peter Werbe Show is Rich Benjamin. The book is Searching for Whitopia, an improbable journey to the heart of white America. Now, the integration of Detroit began probably 75 years ago in the 1920s. And there's some famous cases that where huge mobs would drive out black homeowners that had bought in a, quote, so-called white neighborhood. And probably this anti-integration movement had its greatest expression in what is unfortunately Detroit's largest mass movement, bigger than the unions, and that was the white homeowners movements of the 1950s here. Now, what they said, and this is what is so unfortunate, and this is hard for people to get their minds around, everything that these people that wanted to enforce residential segregation said, if we integrate our neighborhoods, Detroit will become crime-ridden, our property values will drive be driven down, and our schools will go to hell. So when people, there's not a lot of people left from that era, but if you, if some of them, if you see them, they'll say everything we said was true, that black people ruined Detroit. That, you know, that it was, I quote, the code word, sometimes they say Detroit used to be a nice place to live. And the quality of life has sunk enormously there. What sort of response do you have to that?
Well, there's no denying that Detroit has suffered from some really horrible leadership in the last three decades. And I think that's unfortunate. But to equate integration with the community decline just doesn't hold water. There are all sorts of communities across the country that have been integrated and that have had all sorts of diverse leadership that haven't gone to hell. Maplewood, New Jersey, many parts of Brooklyn, New York, Berkeley, California, New Mexico. New Mexico is now a state where white people are in the minority, and by most accounts, New Mexico is doing wonderfully and thriving, and many people would give their arm to live in places in New Mexico. So this idea that because you've integrated something, it's gone to hell, is faulty logic. If you put that in a social science class, you'd fail. Integration equals failure.
Well, also, the deindustrialization, and that's really the key to it, the economic base
right.
of Detroit, collapsed beginning in the 1950s. People think, right. oh, there was a huge riot uprising here in 1967. Things had already been, you know, economically going downhill quite reasonably. If the same industries would have stayed here and provided the kind of jobs and opportunities for people, regardless of color, we'd probably still be what once Detroit, for I don't know why, but was called the Paris of the United States. Rich Benjamin is with me for a few minutes more. His book is Searching for Whitetopia, An Improbable Journey to the Heart of White America. So we said at the beginning of the show that attitudes, that racialist attitudes have begun to significantly decline, particularly among young people, but institutionally. And that means that brings up a class analysis, is that African Americans are and Hispanic Americans are disproportionately represented among the lower working class and the poor. So ultimately, I would say it's not about race at all. It's about class. It's about distribution of wealth and what have you.
Yes. Class has very much to do with this. I think one of the most poignant moments for me when I was on my journey was in North Idaho. I had befriended a fellow who couldn't afford to live in that community, and therefore he was renting out of a storage unit and living out of that.
Oh,
now, that very afternoon, right, who would have thought? That very afternoon, I went to a meet and greet, quote unquote, for Senator Crapo. He's Idaho's Republican senator, and he promised that intimate gathering of supporters more tax relief. So one of the surprising lessons of my journey is that when white people gentrify a community, sometimes the initial residents are white. And so the initial residents of certain communities in North Idaho can't afford to raise their kids in the very community they grew up in.
Yeah, a lot of these resort towns in Colorado, even some here in Michigan. But, race, as I used the phrase right at the beginning of this broadcast, about being a conundrum that's been with us since the origins of this country, and asking you, Rich Benjamin, to come up with a solution seems a little bit much, but things must occur to you. Now, I know the Demos Institute that you work for is always thinking a lot about this stuff. So is there at least anything in general that you would point to? Social policy, legislation, why can't we all get along? What?
Absolutely. I'll give you an example. Westchester County, for example, which is an upscale bedroom community of New York City, the Clintons happen to live there, receives federal money for all sorts of purposes. The federal government sent affordable housing benchmarks, inclusionary zoning benchmarks, only to learn that Westchester County was deceiving the federal government about meeting those benchmarks. So once Westchester County was sued, it had to reach a settlement saying that, in effect, it would improve affordable housing, it would improve inclusionary zoning. So my point being, as we continue to rebuild this country and improve this country, specifically with that $800 billion of stimulus money, as we build bridges and highways and broadbands and roads, we need to do so in a way that's integrating to this country and equitable. Taxpayers, in my opinion, shouldn't be asked to subsidize segregation as we did in the 1950s.
Well, I think that when you look at some of the, and I think your phrase, equitable, is key here. I mean, why do we have an imaginary line on one side, great schools, and on the other side, some of the worst in the nation? And that we've always, the call on Halloween, help the poor. Well, these are our neighbors, and these are people that are part of our community, and we need sort of a Marshall Plan for cities like Detroit, and that there ought to be an equitable distribution of tax money, for instance, for rebuilding Detroit and creating good schools and also the creation of good jobs, which I think is probably a little bit beyond what we could suggest in such a short time. Well, I want to thank you so much for being with me. Barbara Ehrenreich, who wrote the incredible book Nickel and Dimed, although she has a brand new book out, says of Rich Benjamin's book, a daring feat of 21st century exploration that will have you laughing and shuddering at the same time. The book is Searching for Whitopia, an improbable journey to the heart of white America, and it is published by Hyperion. You can go to richbenjamin.com, and there'll be more there. Also, there'll be a link on my website, Peter Werbe. That's Werbe. Rich Benjamin, thanks for taking the time for being on my show.
Thank you, Peter. Thanks a lot.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with another guest right after this.
Feels like time's running out. Maxed out on your credit cards, collection calls are coming every day, and you're two payments behind on your mortgage. You need help. We're Credit Card Relief, and we've been helping people just like you for nearly a decade. Call Credit Card Relief right now. The consultation is free, and the relief is real.
Call 866-290-8282. Not available in all states. Call 866-290-8282. That's 866-290-8282.
101, The Riff.
101, WRIF.
The Riff.
Hi, this is Mark Schmeier from Creed.
The Riff. Hey, everybody, this is Dave Grohl from the Foo Fighters.
The Riff.
Hey, it's Casey.
This is Chad.
This is Chris.
This is Brian from Cabo.
And you've got it on Detroit's rock station, 101 WRIF, The Riff.
Everything rocks. Detroit's rock station, 101 WRIF.
The Riff.
We're back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. Peter Werby here with you. You know, there's so many, I guess we would say, disturbed people in this society acting out. And perhaps the most dramatic comes in the violence that we see within families, mass murders, just a frightening population, even though probably the vast majority of us just go about our business and suffer our little emotional and psychological miseries by ourselves. Well, there's help out there, as we know. There's all sorts of drugs and therapy for those of us who feel that they need help. And the quality of it and the nature of it is something that's continually under discussion by people in the profession and also by lay people as well, to figure out how can we stop from being unhinged. And I use that that word unhinged because that's the name of a book we're going to interview its author. The author is Daniel J. Carlett. He's a medical doctor. The book is called Unhinged, The Trouble with Psychiatry, A Doctor's Revelations About a Profession in Crisis. And Daniel Carlett is on the faculty of Tufts Medical School. Did his psychiatric training at Harvard Medical School and Massachusetts General Hospital. He was chief resident of the inpatient psychiatric unit. He's published many professional books and articles. He's currently the editor-in-chief of the Carlett Psychiatry Report. It's a monthly newsletter, and that's mostly for clinicians. He's also an occasional contributor to the New York Times Magazine. He's published articles on psychiatric and medical topics. We're reaching him in Newburyport, Massachusetts. Daniel Carlett, welcome to the Peter Werby Show.
Thank you very much for having me, Peter.
Well, let's maybe just go for some definitions. When people, you know, used to be the old phrase, maybe in the 30s or the 40s, they'd say, yeah, you're going to a head shrinker. And so we never were quite clear whether one was going to a psychiatrist, a psychoanalyst, a therapist, a counselor. Who's who in all this?
It's very confusing, actually, and a lot of people don't know. So a psychiatrist is the one who goes to medical school.
That's you.
And that's me.
Yeah.
So I suffered through years of medical school, quite an ordeal. If any listener out there is planning to go, you might want to think twice. And then I can do both psychotherapy and prescribe psychotropic, as we call them, medications. So these are, you know, typical things like Prozac and Zyprexa or Abilify, which is the one that's been hitting the airwaves a lot on the direct-to-consumer advertising front. And then there are others. There's psychologists and social workers and marriage, family, and child counselors, all of whom do talk therapy. Generally speaking, however, they cannot prescribe medications, with the exception of two states, New Mexico and Louisiana, where psychologists have actually been given prescriptive privileges by their state legislatures.
Now, it's interesting, you still deal with the mind, whether it's talking or prescribing drugs, yet you spent this enormous amount of time in medical school, sometimes looking at the other end, right, to how to do those kind of examinations. What's the purpose of a psychiatrist doing a general medical background, and the kind of training you did doesn't seem, at least on the face of it, to be directly applicable to the kind of work you're doing with emotions?
It's kind of a bizarre situation, which is one reason why I wrote the book. So here we have a training program where I went to 8 years of postgraduate training. That means after graduating from college, I did 8 more years of training, medical school, internship, psychiatric residency. And a lot of that was medical training, learning how to do a physical exam, learning how to keep a patient alive in the ICU when they're having a heart attack, delivering babies, reading x-rays, etc. But the really strange thing is that in my practice, and this is true of almost all psychiatrists, what I actually do is I sit down in a comfortable chair in a coat and tie, not always wearing a tie, and patients come in and sit in a comfortable chair, and I chat with them. And essentially how I diagnose is I don't do blood tests or x-rays, or I don't do physical exams, but I diagnose by having a meeting of the minds. And I'm asking questions, and I'm getting history. And I put together a diagnosis that may or may not lead to a medication. So I've often wondered, why in the world do we go to medical school? How much of our training do we really use? I think it's very little, actually.
Man, your book is called Unhinged, and the subtitle is The Trouble with Psychiatry, A Doctor's Revelations About a Profession in Crisis, and some big words there, trouble, revelations, crisis. What's that all about? When this at least hasn't percolated up to the patient and layman's level yet, or has it? I've sort of missed it, I guess. What's happening here?
Yeah, well, there are many ways in which my profession is, you might say, under siege. One of them is ethically. So most listeners have probably been hearing about the pharmaceutical companies that have been doing unethical marketing practices and have actually had to pay $1 or $2 billion fines in the case of Eli Lilly, for example, or Pfizer, for having done shady things trying to get doctors to prescribe their products. And that is one piece of the pie that has happened in psychiatry more so than the other specialties for reasons that are not always clear, but that's been the case. That's one part of the puzzle. The other part is just that there's a real fragmentation, as I call it, of care. So if you see a psychiatrist, you kind of expect somebody to talk to you and understand your problems, maybe prescribe a medication, but also do some talk therapy. That happens very rarely now. Usually you'll get somebody who sits with you for an hour at the first visit, but then will give you a prescription and then refer you on to someone who is considered by the profession lower in the, quote, pecking order, sort of lower in the hierarchy, which would be a psychologist or a social worker. That's not my term, though. I don't consider them lower in the hierarchy, mm-hmm. but there's an elitist attitude in the profession, to be quite frank, where the psychiatrists feel that since they've gone to medical school, they're better than their colleagues who have not gone to medical school.
Well, I was thinking, a friend of mine who was in therapy, talking therapy with a psychologist, in order to get anti-anxiety medicine, has to also see a psychiatrist. And she would go there, and the psychiatrist would say, how you been doing? Do you think this is effective? And say, yeah, I'm doing good, like that. And what's happening in your life? And she said, well, we're going on vacation. And said, where is it? Oh, up north in Michigan. And he said, oh, we have a cottage up there. And they just, for like 15 minutes, they sort of chatted about vacations. And I thought, wow. And then he, re-prescribed the anxiety medicine, whereas I was thinking, I can't imagine what he just, and the waiting room is filled with people similarly situated like that, and I can't imagine what he billed, the Health Alliance plan.
Right. Yeah. Well, I can tell you because I bill them myself. I mean, that was probably a $60 or $70 15-minute visit, and that's kind of typical. And the strange thing is that that doctor went to 8 years of medical training in order to conduct a visit like that, and they're getting the big bucks for it. So what's happening is that there are these massive turf wars between the professions, between psychiatrists and psychologists, where the psychologists want to get prescribing privileges, but the psychiatrists don't want them. And of course, the whole battle is framed in terms of patient safety, but everybody knows the hidden driver behind it all is money. The psychiatrists want to protect their professional turf. In my mind, the better way to practice is if you can do both the medication and the therapy. So, your friend who went to see someone diagnosed with anxiety, why is it that they have to then go look for a psychiatrist, get on a waiting list, which is often, 2, 3, 4 months, pay another copay, have a whole other conversation with somebody, rather than getting the medication from the original person that got to know them? And that's the kind of integrative treatment. I feel like I'm, back in California in the 1980s talking about holistic, but it is back to that sort of terminology that we need again. We need an integrative practitioner who can do it all, mm-hmm. but we don't have that system now.
The book is Unhinged, The Trouble with Psychiatry, A Doctor's Revelations About a Profession in Crisis. So my guest is Dr. Daniel Carlett, and this is published by Simon & Schuster. You can go to danielcarlett.com. It's Daniel and then CARLAT.com. There'll also be a link on my website, Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E. com. Now, I was just looking, I talk about going back into the history of all this, Eric Fromm's book, The Sane Society, and he was at one point, I think if I remember right, that he's talking about that if a single individual manifested all the emotions and actions that are prevalent in this society, we'd probably have the person put away. So when you have such a level of anxiety and panic attacks and other things that many people say are caused by great emotional distress, isn't it sort of frustrating or difficult or maybe even impossible to treat each one of our ailments individually?
Yeah, it is. And there's an interesting notion that one of my colleagues, Larry Diller, he's a pediatrician, treats a lot of attention deficit disorder. And, attention deficit disorder is one of those diseases that everybody thinks they have.
Sure.
Who doesn't have it, right?
I have it.
You have it, I have it. And the thing is, if I were to prescribe you, Peter, a dose of Ritalin or Adderall, guess what? You'd feel a lot better and you would focus a lot better because what Adderall is speed. And so we have a lot of psychiatrists prescribing a version or other of speed to people. And it works, but, the overdiagnosis is what concerns me. And there are a lot of people out there who, have very busy, hectic lives, who find themselves sometimes lacking focus and not being able to remember what they were doing or not finishing things. And solution for that isn't necessarily speed. The solution for that might be to slow down a little bit and make different priorities, get a day planner. I mean, there's a lot of solutions. But this is one of the, I'd say, occupational risks of being a psychiatrist is the diagnosis of life conditions and the definition of these as medical illnesses.
Well, sure, and it occurs to me, if I sit down to work, like on a computer, and I'm writing an article, and then I thought, I forgot, this reminds me, I'm supposed to email somebody, and then you go, whoa, look at this story that just popped up. This is pretty interesting. Oh, man, tomorrow's garbage day. I better go take out this stuff. And, oh, man, I told my wife I was going to vacuum, so I better, well, what am I doing vacuuming? I got to finish this article. So that, on the face of it, appears to me to be a symptom of being ADD, yet I can sit in a 3-hour and 20-minute opera. I can take a 3 or 4-hour Tai Chi class. I can walk endlessly in the mountains or in the woods. So, yeah, it's I've just got too much going in my life.
Yeah, and I think it's great that you have a lot going in your life, and I would not want to prescribe you a medication for that. I mean, but this is a problem throughout psychiatry. Our diagnoses are hard to nail down. We don't have a blood test or an X-ray finding that we can use to say, oh, you have ADHD or you have depression. Clearly, there are some people that have these symptoms severely. And I have plenty of patients who have had ADHD to the extent that they've just been non-functional, haven't been able to finish school, haven't been able to do a job or keep a job. And sometimes they do great on medications. And that's true for other psychiatric ailments, whether you're talking about depression or anxiety disorders or social phobia, which people snicker when they hear that term because they say, well, isn't that just shyness? Well, yeah, it is kind of just shyness, but there are people out there that are so painfully shy that they really need treatment in order to just function in the world. So I don't want to go overboard and say that we're medicalizing all of life's experiences, but that's always the risk in a discipline like psychiatry.
Yeah, I'm Daniel Carlett. I don't know if you're familiar with a talk show colleague of mine, Tom Hartman, but he's written I think he's had training as a therapist, but he's written about ADD and ADHD, and he, of course, says that some of your life choices are important. If they put someone like me as an accountant, in a small cubicle trying to make numbers come out the same in two columns, I would probably be needing to take a lot of medicine. Whereas if I work as a DJ and change the song every 3.5 minutes or change the topic every 4 or 5 minutes, it works out swell for me.
Yeah, and that's probably true of other people as well. I mean, there's been a lot of talk about autism and the autism spectrum. People may have heard the term Asperger's disorder, which is people who are a little bit socially awkward, but who are often very intelligent and very good with a particular kind of often scientific pursuit. Those are the people that might have been responsible for the internet boom that we experienced. It could be that Silicon Valley is filled with people who might have a diagnosis of a mild form of autism, but these are not the kind of people that we want to, quote, cure, because they've been able to find a kind of profession that uses their skills to advantage so they can help mm-hmm. other people out. So that's quite right.
Daniel Carla, in your book, Unhinged, you talk about, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, which is called the DSM. And you talk about that in 1968, when it first was published, there was 182 diagnoses, and now it's up to 400. And there's always a suspicion on the part of lay people, or am I just talking about myself, that this is just like a big scam. I mean, you know, that shyness becomes that kind of disorder, and that the disorder are expanding enormously, so we get more and more people in therapy and more people consuming drugs.
Yeah, and the DSM, it's a really problematic and complicated book. I mean, if you were to pick it up, it's hefty. It's got hundreds of pages and over 400 different labels. The problem is that these labels really don't mean anything objective. These labels are all created by humans, typically committees of mainly male psychiatrists sitting in a room, trying to figure out how to define something like depression. And since we don't have objective criteria, they come up with something like, well, let's say 5 out of 9 possible symptoms. If a patient has that for 2 weeks, then we're going to call that major depression. But if they only have 4, then we're not going to call that major depression. Arbitrary, but yet these arbitrary distinctions have massive implications in society, because if you do meet those criteria, you get the diagnosis, and your doctor will get reimbursed, and you maybe can get disability payments if you have the diagnosis. So there's financial implications, and there are stigma implications of it. It's symptomatic of the field that is scientific. I don't like it when people say psychiatry is not a science, because I think it is. I just think it's an incredibly primitive science, because the brain, which is the organ that we treat, is monstrously complicated.
When you write a book like this, Unhinged, The Trouble with Psychiatry, A Doctor's Revelations About a Profession in Crisis, how do your colleagues take this? I mean, you're sort of like a whistleblower.
It really depends on the colleague and what I'm saying. I mean, one of the things that I'm quoted as saying is that my colleagues have become pill pushers, and a lot of psychiatrists take umbrage to that, saying, we're not pill pushers, we actually do psychotherapy. And then you get into these long, drawn-out discussions. Well, what do you mean by therapy? I mean, if I sit down with somebody and say, hi, how you doing? You know, where's your lake house, like your friend? Some psychiatrists would certainly argue that 15 minutes of just chatting pleasantly with somebody is therapy, because you're establishing a therapeutic alliance. Well, I think that's preposterous. I mean, psychotherapy implies a certain number of specific techniques and skills that, allow you to treat symptoms. And they don't necessarily, therapy doesn't have to be the old version of lying on a couch 5 days a week and having a Viennese analyst, ask you questions now and then. It can be, once a week. It can be 30 minutes every couple of weeks. whatever the patient needs. But the idea that simply writing out a prescription and patting someone on the back and saying something to make them feel a little bit better is actually psychotherapy, I think, is wrong.
Mm-hmm. Let's go back a little to what I was talking about earlier about actually larger social and political considerations or cultural considerations. And I'm, you know, back to Eric Fromm and maybe even back farther to crazy old Dr. Wilhelm Reich, who talked about mass psychology, so that when you have a society in which almost 1 in 10 Americans are suffering from clinical depression and probably who knows how many are getting untreated, when you have obesity at the level that they are, these are individual problems. They manifest themselves as individual problems, but it's part of a sort of a mass psychology, no?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. I mean, and we become more of a psychological society. If you look at the prevalence of illnesses like autism or like bipolar disorder over the last several years, you'll see that they're apparently skyrocketing. But does that mean that people are actually going crazier over the last couple of decades? I don't think so. It just means that these diagnoses are now forefront on our minds, and we are looking for them and we're trying to recognize them, and we're trying to come up with solutions to problems. And obesity is a good example. We are about to probably have a new diagnostic category in the DSM called binge eating disorder, which is sort of like bulimia, where you eat a whole lot at one sitting, except in this case you don't do anything to purge it. Now, are we going to end up calling everybody who is overweight somebody with binge eating disorder? Does that mean that obesity now becomes a psychiatric diagnosis that has to be treated by a psychologist or a psychiatrist? I don't think that's the right direction to go in.
Mm-hmm. Well, we just have a little bit more time. If you talk about a profession in crisis, in fact, almost to the point where it's unhinged, the title of your book is, where would you like to see the profession move? Or what's needed here to bring it out of crisis?
We need to clean up our act ethically in terms of our relationships with the pharmaceutical industry, which we're doing, and that part of it, I think, is starting to get under control. But the other thing is that psychiatrists have painted themselves in a corner where all they do is prescribe meds. They do very little therapy. So either the field needs to retrain itself, regear its training, to do more talk therapy, or we need to allow other professions like psychologists to take 2-year training programs, which they can do in some states, in order to prescribe. Because really what my field, what psychiatry is, it's really a psychological profession with a little medicine added on to it. It's not something that you need to go to medical school in order to do competently.
Would that be something, though, to be able to be, you could then almost say that people could have the same kind of training that therapists and counselors have with the additional ability to prescribe medicines that would...
Yeah, and if there is enough training, I think that can be done safely. So a psychologist goes to a psychology graduate school and they do 5 or 6 years of schooling in therapy techniques after they graduate college. And then there are psychopharmacology master's programs that they can take where they can learn the basics of how to prescribe drugs that they are likely to use. Not cardiac drugs, not cancer drugs. We're talking about things like Prozac or Zoloft, drugs that are actually very easy to prescribe that have very few side effects. And they can be taught the basics and how to do the basic part of the physical exam, how to draw blood work to monitor levels of drugs. These things don't require medical school to learn. So I think the future will be that we will have these sort of more integrative practitioners who, when you go see someone, you know, you call someone in the phone book, you have a problem, you'll talk to them, they'll really understand you, they'll do the talk therapy, and by the way, when you really need a medication, they'll be able to pull out the pad and prescribe the medication for you as well, and it'll all be part of being treated by the same person.
Well, I want to thank you so much for being with us. My guest has been Daniel J. Carlett. He's a medical doctor, a psychiatrist. His book is Unhinged, The Trouble with Psychiatry, A Doctor's Revelations About a Profession in Crisis. It's published by Simon & Schuster. You can go to Daniel Carlett. It's carlat.com. There'll also be a link on my website, Peter Werbe, werbe.com. Thanks for being on the broadcast.
No, it's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Night Call on 101 WRIF. The views expressed on the program are not necessarily those of the staff, management, or ownership of WRIF Radio. Now, stay tuned for more Riff Rock on 101 WRIF Detroit.
Time's running out. You're maxed out on your credit cards. The collection calls are coming every day, and now you're two payments behind on your mortgage. Every time you turn on the radio, there's some cheerful couple telling you how they got out of debt overnight. Their stress is gone, and everything's just wonderful. Come on. The truth is, what sounds too good to be true is too good to be true. You need real help, and you need it now. Not bankruptcy. That should be your last choice. We're Credit Card Relief, and we've been helping people just like you for nearly a decade. We're the attorney-driven program, dedicated to helping you get out of debt in months instead of years, saving you thousands, and without risking your family home. We know what we're doing, and we don't make promises we can't keep. The consultation is free, and the relief is real.
Get out of debt. Call Credit Card Relief at 866-290-8282. Not available in all states. That's Credit Card Relief. 866-290-8282. 866-290-8282. If you want a new computer but think you can't get credit, think again. Just call Tronics Country right now. No matter what your credit status is, now you can own a brand new desktop or laptop computer. Your approval is guaranteed as long as you have an active checking account and can afford small weekly payments. With Tronics Country, there's no credit check. You will not be turned down. Call right now and order your new computer. You'll also get a free color printer and a free digital camera. Just call 800-990-2258. But that's not all. Call right now and you'll also get a free 22-inch high-definition TV with your paid purchase. You heard right. A free TV with your new computer. All you need is an active checking account and your approval is guaranteed. Don't wait. Call Tronics Country right now. Call 800-990-2258. That's 800-990-2258. 800-990-2258. Did you know the tap water in your home may be hazardous? Not to your health, but to your appliances and your wallet. Your home's hard water creates pipe clogging line scale, and that can shorten the life of your water heater, ruin your dishwasher, and break down your washing machine. Lime scale deposits block the heating element, and that could be costing you an extra $1,200 a year in energy and wear. But you can remove lime scale without chemicals, magnets, or salts. It's easy with HydraCare, the patented device used worldwide. See for yourself at bestsoftwater.com. You simply clip HydraCare to your main water pipe. HydraCare removes and prevents lime scale buildup in your entire plumbing system. If your home has hard water, extend the life of your appliances with HydraCare. Try it risk-free. Just go to bestsoftwater.com. That's bestsoftwater.com. Or call now, 888-883-8187. That's 888-883-8187.
Take it.
Everything that rocks.
It's ridiculous, but I love it.
101 The Riff.